Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head on Radio Network.
Oh, howdy. Coming up on 3 minutes past the hour on this Tuesday, the 22nd day of October 2013, this is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button. That's where you'll find the access to the chat room, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. And that's where you'll find the PayPal button, which is how we keep this whole affair running and have done so for a considerable number of years now. Our 8th anniversary as a standalone internet radio broadcast operation will be coming on Thursday, and I'm seriously considering putting off our trip until Friday. We'll be kind of pressing it a little bit, but I want to be broadcasting on the 8th anniversary, because 8 years of doing something like progressive radio is a milestone not to be missed. So, let's see. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Titanic Tuesday, named for the Titanic intellect on display just about anywhere you can look inside the right-wing nutosphere as they motivate themselves about walking on their knuckles, breathing through their mouths, getting drool all over themselves, howling like rabid chimpanzees that they are, hopping up and down, screaming, beating on each other. But, you know, Republicans, teabaggers. I want to get things started this evening by noting that Dr. John has put forward a challenge for the evening. I think Dr. Bill just mentioned, and rightly so, that we ended up the evening last night in a rather deep and nasty hole, which is a tough way to begin a week. We wound up, we made it to $40 out of the $250 we were trying to raise, so that leaves $210, $200, $260, $460 to raise this evening. Dr. John is willing to match the first $50 that comes in with $50 of his own, so that would take a considerable bite out of what we need to raise just to keep even. So thank you very kindly. Ed jumped in right at the beginning of the program, getting us started with $25. So that is a huge, huge step forward. Thank you, Ed. Thank you so very much. And our best to all of you, to your family. Thank you very much. Let's see. It's Titanic Tuesday, but I want to catch up with something or keep ahead of or pull even with. I don't know. Something that got started last night, I put out a generalized call for the international community and got back a couple of really Jim Day responses, as well as a number of others, but in the interest of, I'm just going to share a couple of those with you. By the way, phones that weren't screwed up are now. I just noticed something a minute ago. We had a call coming in right at showtime, and I'm doing about 19 dozen different things at one time when the show begins. So my apologies for not picking up the line, but not to get technical, we have what here called a hunt group that is telephone lines, so that if the first one's busy, it rolls to the second, if the third, yada, yada, yada. Well, got a call this morning saying that they had fixed it. It was working last night, but they fixed it. And the way they apparently fixed it is such that the line doesn't roll. So we'll have to see what happens this evening and try to figure out what to do from there. Oh, well. Which means some more of my life spent on tech support. Oh, Jesus. I love, I love sitting on hold. Hold hell, I like to call it. Waiting for tech support to... But anyway, no, it's Titanic Tuesday, but let's start with a couple of emails. Going back to my question last night, what would, you know, what in civilized countries that don't have to fret about freedom protecting, Second Amendment remedy toting right wing goobers from, you know, right goober stand, feeling like they need to take a damned gun with them to a high school football game, what do you guys worry about? This note came in from Lauren in Canada, and here's what Lauren says. She says, I have no idea what homecoming is that you went to, other than it evidently has something to do with school football. It's an American thing, I guess. Well, yeah, it is. Homecoming is this, it's an excuse to pick out kings and queens and princesses and all those trappings of monarchy that we supposedly got shed of back long about 1776 or 1783 or 1787, depending on which date you prefer. And it's supposed to be a specific time at which people who have graduated from the alma mater, be it high school or college, come back to the campus and relive the salad days of their halcyon youth. Yeah. Anyway, so that's what homecoming is. But Lauren continues, your story about the dude with the gun is terrifying. If I ever saw anyone with a gun here in Alberta, I would immediately call the cops. It did remind me, and see, I thought about that last Friday night. Hey, why don't I go tell a cop there's a guy here with a gun? And then, just because of the way my mind works, it sort of played, I sort of played the scenario out where the cop walks up and says, Mister, do you have a gun? And the guy goes, you're goddamn right I've got a gun. I'm protecting freedom, Wolverines! And mayhem ensues. Even cops, it turns out, are not very good at using firearms in the heat of the moment. And I'm not talking about the rather syrupy song. Asia from the mid-1980s. So that's why I didn't say anything. Maybe I was wrong. But Lauren says, it did remind me of a recent episode of a show we have called Border Security. I'm sure it has the obligatory semi-martial sort of terrifying music, no doubt, which is on the National Geographic Channel. It's based on a very similar show in Oz, but this one mainly takes place at the Vancouver airport and at the border crossing south of Vancouver. On this episode, a family, mom, dad, baby, and toddler, got lost on their way to the Peace Arch Park for the day. I like that. You gotta think well of any town that has a Peace Arch. And ended up at Canadian Customs. Of course, the very first thing they were asked is if they were carrying guns. These were Americans, remember. And as a young family off to spend the day in the Peace Park, yes, they were both packing heat. Dad had his gun in a shoulder holster, while Mama kept hers in the diaper bag. The border guards were pretty surprised. Various bureaucratic things were done. The guns were confiscated. Then a U.S. border guard had to walk over, take the guns, and go back to his station. Mom and Dad and the kids were allowed to return to the U.S. border, and their guns, on entering Washington State, were returned to them. I bet they felt unsafe in those few hundred yards between the Canadian and U.S. stations with no way to defend themselves. Well, heavens yes, Lauren. I mean, you've got socialism medicine up there and probably Kenyan Muslims under every rock. Lauren says, I hope they had a nice day at the Peace Arch Park with their babies, their diapers, and their guns. America, hell yeah. And then this note from our buddy Scott in Sweden. Hey, Bobbery Bob. Since you conjured the international community with the question, what y'all worry about when you go to a football game, let's ignore the big professional matches and that Stockholm has three teams in the top league where the worry is hooliganism and getting accidentally caught between the dumbass teens and 20-somethings as they jostle and toss beer cans at each other. The actual fights are usually scheduled for some out-of-the-way wharf after midnight. Well, at least they're throwing beer cans, Scott. They're not throwing cans of Sir Stroming. Whew, that could get ugly in a hurry. Instead, what do I worry about at a similarly scaled local event such as your high school football match? How about SCO IK hockey matches? Little SCO, our local club, punches a little above its weight athletically and is only two leagues from the top. Accordingly, it has a pretty lively fan base. Bob, I don't know what the hell you're belly aching over a little bitty pistol for. That's nothing compared to the worries I have. Here's a baker's dozen. Believe me, there are a whole lot more than these. Worry one. Will the canned music once again be way too loud as the club tries to imitate the excitement at much larger arenas by substituting loudspeaker volume for actual enthusiastic crowd hubbub? I always dread, yes, I'm a grouch, that the knucklehead in the booth will play anything by, shiver, ABBA to please we gray-haired individuals. Worse, will they play we will rock you more than the customary dozen times? This would be bad enough outdoors when the sound readily dissipates, but in a metal-roofed hockey rink with only human bodies to absorb the sound waves, each additional decibel is a fire. Bullet. Worry 2. Yet to bring a foam pad and literally fix my butt on the mess. Worry 3. Will the concession stand run out of regular must and only have the nasty flavored spicy must? 4. Will my attention last seconds before a wave flies into the crowd where I'm sitting? Worry 5. Will Anders bring his godforsaken vuvuzela that he picked up at the 2010 South African World Cup and toot that damn thing all evening? Worry 6. Will Christine be there and in a flirtatious mood? Worry 7. Will Bjorn see me and want to practice his English? Worry 8. Will, despite the ban, some idiot think it cool to set off a green or yellow, SCO's colors, smoke bomb after we score a goal? Here, too, it's almost acceptable outdoors, but indoors, it's been a while since the last time, but as a worry, it's a big one because it's bound to happen sooner or later. Worry 9. Will the game still be close at the end of the second period, making it hard to bug out of this madhouse early? Worry 10. Will Christine, different Christine, this one with an H, the other one had a C, not only be flirtatious, but a little bit tipsy? Nope, that was the same Christine, my bad. Worry 11. Will Gusta never realize that Division 3 is simply Division 3 and chill out? Must every whistle going against SCO trigger such Sturm und Drang? Worry 12. Will both Susan and Pear show up and force the rest of us to hear who was really at fault for the divorce? Worry 13. Will I be equally lucky next year and win the season ticket raffle again? Yours sincerely, our buddy Scott. That's our period buddy Scott. And he is. He's our buddy Scott. The Swede. P.S. Please explain. Okay, we will. Please explain the cry, Wolverines! You gotta say it like that, you know. I always thought it had something to do with your beloved Mountaineers losing its coaches to the University of Michigan. But since you just played a cheesy sound clip replete with pasted-in bullet noises representing every ricochet cliche I've ever heard, you've left me clueless. A shout of, Badgers! I could understand, as they have been blamed in the UK as being a carrier of tuberculosis, or Skunk! For the obvious reason, but Wolverine! Why not Raccoon! Beaver! Squirrel! Or the hybrid Squeaver! What's up with Wolverines? Rabies? Halitosis? Rut musk? Oh, Scott, you've been gone. Gone from these freedom-loving shores far too long, buddy. Wolverines, of course, refers to that inestimably bad film from the 1980s that featured... And the remake of last year... Was it this year? That posed a terrifying, I mean, truly sleep loss inducing scenario where in the old movie, and I prefer the classics, the old movie featured people somewhere out in the Midwest being invaded by Cubans. You know, you just wake up one day and there's a whole bunch of bearded, cigar smoking Cubans running around taking away your freedom and your democracy. And the new one did feature the Chinese, and I guess we went belly up on the dead or something, and the Chinese invaded. But Hollywood had to reshoot that when they realized that they desperately wanted to be... The name of the movie is Red Dawn. and Hollywood had to redo the villains and turn them into North Koreans when they suddenly realized in a fit of suddenly or temporarily displaced capitalism. That's what made them not Chinese. But getting back to their capitalist roots, the same roots that did business with the Nazis and allowed the Third Reich to rewrite entire films. I'll never watch, as noted, I will never watch Mr. Smith Goes to Washington again, because who knew that the little dictator with the Charlie Chaplin mustache was a big fan of Jimmy Stewart. Oh, my God. He really was. And the Nazis just loved Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, because it presented the fact that democracy never works, it's too ugly, it's too unruly, and only a strong man with firm dedication and convictions can get anything done in government. Go figure. But anyway, the studio relooped or re-somethinged so that the villains invading in the modern version of Red Dawn were North Koreans. When we all know that if North Korea invaded, the first thing they would invade would be the first damned Ralph's grocery store they could find somewhere in Southern California. God knows they couldn't afford Whole Foods. But that then, and so that then, Scott, is the source of Wolverines! Because every time they kill, especially in the classic version, every time they kill a bad Cuban, and they're all bad Cubans, aren't they? I mean, really. Every time they kill a bad Cuban, they scream, Wolverines! You know, because they're protecting freedom. Meanwhile, Irish Dave is always ready with an improvement. Bob, think the classic Red Dawn was set in the Rockies. In the Midwest, it would have been Pekin, Illinois, and the war whoop of Jinx! Jesus! Yeah, it was set in the Rockies, but the Cubans invaded them anyway. Irish Dave suggesting weasels. Oh, see what happens when I start talking about this stuff? Goodness gracious. Ron and Raleigh, get the bad guys correct, Bob. In the original, the invasion was led by Cubans and Soviets, with the Nicaraguan army doing the heavy lifting. Oh, God, how could I forget Daniel Ortega? You're right, Ron, you're absolutely right. So they weren't all Cubans, but all the Cubans were bad, and all the Soviets were bad, and all the Nicaraguans were bad. And the screen treatment for it was born out of that moment of greasy-headed B-movie actor paranoia when Ronald Reagan told America that Texas was under threat from the Nicaraguan commies, and that the Contras, that it turned out he illegally funded and should have been impeached for funding by selling arms to the Iranians in exchange for the hostages they had to... right. All right, this is... Okay, this is going to get out of hand in a hurry. This is right up there with our Meet the Feetles evening. Jan and Jerry in Nevada. Prairie Dogs! Meerkats! They're kind of kin to prairie dogs, aren't they? Platypi! Jim noting that movie night for Adolph and Ava, Gone with the Wind was also a favorite shown at the Berghoff. Ava Braun had this notion in her head that she was Vivian Leigh, i.e. Scarlett, and no, really, the little Austrian corporal was Clark Gable. Frankly, Scarlett, I do not give a verdammt. Haben Sie gehabt, haben geworden sein? Jesus. Yeah, that's what it was. Randy and PA pointing out that Wolverines comes from the fact that the high school football team, see how the thread works out, the goddess of irony, always working. The high school football team was named the Wolverines in Red Dawn. So they used their football team cheer whenever they killed a commie. Dr. John with an inquiry. That great documentary, Red Dawn, did they ever explain why that all-star cast of international commies wanted to invade the Rockies? Were they looking for good microbrews? I think that was even before the microbrews. If you think about it, Soviets, Cubans, Nicaraguans, I think the ultimate goal was to overpower and then nationalize the ski slopes around Vail and Telluride. Can you imagine? You spend your life living on a tropical island or on a tropical isthmus, and all you ever wanted to do was shoosh through the fresh, dry powder, down the mountain from Vail, and spend a quiet evening with your commie honey around the fire, sipping hot buttered rum. Cuban rum, of course. Oh, here we go. Randy and PA. Ocelots! Sticking with Wolverines. I mean, I'm an authenticity guy. Randy pointing out, no, Dr. John. They were looking for Rocky Mountain oysters. Under tooled leather. Yum. Yum. Oy. So, right. So thanks for your Lauren, and thanks to our buddy Scott Esquire for your input on life and civilization. And it's possible that folks think that I'm being somehow tongue in cheek or facetious when I describe places like Canada or Europe or Australia or even sadly radiated Japan as civilization as compared with the United States. But I'm not joking, especially with regard to certain portions of the United States. Well, okay, see, it all comes together, Dr. John noting, well, that makes sense, Bob, as Marx said, from each according to his wants, to each according to his lift tickets. Big shoosher, Karl Marx. Engels was more of a boogie boarder. Just to go back for a minute, though, or go forward, I suppose. We are not in any wise, as compared to the rest of the developing world, any longer something we should routinely refer to as civilized, which is not. If we are to gauge civilization on fundamental metrics like the ability to be a human being for a relatively long period of time on planet Earth. Dr. John alerted me to an article from Alternet, the article at Alternet by Alex Henderson, talking about life expectancy in certain parts of the United States. Wow, I've opened a real can of worms. All right. Luta notes, Wolverines, it's because that is where NORAD is at, the Rockies, plus countless military installations. Also, the Wolverine happens to be a member of the Weasel family. So, weasels! Thank you, Luta. Robert noting, for those lucky bastards who haven't seen it, the remake of Red Dawn being such a great movie can be watched for free on YouTube, and you'll find out about Wolverines! Question from our buddy Lib in South Carolina. Wasn't Red Dawn produced or financed by Jack Abramoff? I'm not sure, and I didn't know you could do that to a Jack, or to a Bram. So, there we go. No, with this article at Alternet that Dr. John had alerted me to. One of the central points of it is that, and the reason that it features so prominently here on this Titanic Tuesday, Dr. John's subject line says, McDowell County has Haiti-level life expectancy. McDowell County is a couple of hours away from me in the really, really high, steep mountains of the southernmost parts of this state. And it is a bad, bad, heart-rending place, along with Wyoming County and Mingo County. Largely depopulated, mountaintop removal all over the place, poison just raining down all over the region from the blasting hell zones of the corporate profit centers of the mountaintop removal industry. Dr. John sent a link along, and he said, did you see this, Bob? Jesus, I thought Sandra was joking about Haiti with cable. Sometimes we get to laugh here, and then we find out that it's really not a joke. And this being the story from Alternet, Corporate Accountability and Workplace, McDowell County, USA, has close to Haiti's life expectancy. Dr. John observes, it's not that one can decide whether or not to join the class war. And it damn sure isn't about whether you believe in it or not. It's about recognizing that it's a social fact. And then choosing sides. He says, you know, this article is a crystal clear distillation of how inequality has material effects on life, regardless of how many TVs and cars or 92 different kinds of breakfast cereal people can buy. Again, it's over at Internet. It's by Alex Henderson, Corporate Accountability and Workplace, McDowell County, USA, has close to Haiti's life expectancy. Welcome to Third World America. And what it boils down to is this article is a look at life expectancy numbers for which there is a fairly copious amount of data in this country. And things are looking rather bleak. In Fairfax County, Virginia, for instance, which is a very wealthy county, I mean, it's no Loudoun County, Virginia, which is the richest county, single county in the entire United States, but Fairfax County isn't exactly eating beans, generally speaking. The life expectancy in Fairfax County, Virginia, is 81.6 years for males and 84.5 years for females. In Marin County, California, where, yes, once upon a day or so, I wandered around and stared in just slack-jawed hillbilly wonder at the beauty of it all and the gorgeousness of a little town called Mill Valley as night fell upon the Bay Area. In Marin County, California, life expectancy is 81.4 years for men and 85.0 years for women. Consider then McDowell County, West Virginia. Not even on the same map, or not even on the same, kind of on the same graph, but there's so much, well, anyway. The average life expectancy for a male in McDowell County, West Virginia. And the funny thing with, and the math folks can make this a lot clearer than I can, the funny thing about averages is that when you have a number that's an average, there are numbers higher, but more tellingly, there are numbers lower. So in McDowell County, West Virginia, the average life expectancy for a man is 63.9 years. For women, it is 72.9 years. If you are a male born in McDowell County, West Virginia, you are born under a curse. And that curse is that you will spend, 19, on average, 19 fewer years on this sweet little blue-green time machine orb hurtling through the universe. If you are born in McDowell County, West Virginia, you and every last constituent atom of you, magnificently present at the Big Bang itself in some form. Talk about not having pre-birth memories. Will only exist in the shape that is you for on average 63.9 years if you're a guy. That's a hell of a birth curse, isn't it? And here's the kicker. Those 63.9 years are just a statistical tick higher than Haiti. But the cable works real good in McDowell County, long as you can afford it. What don't they have in McDowell County? They do not have easy access to health care. They do not have nearly the income. They do not have the employment opportunities. But Lord God, they've got the prosperity of the coal industry. Now, you can't hang all of this on the coal industry because the numbers are similar in other parts of the South. Just barely outside the last low knee hills of the Appalachians sits Tunica County, Mississippi, blessed this last decade or so, or perhaps a little bit more, by a bunch of casinos by the Mississippi River on old plantation land. I mean, down there on that bottom down there by the Mississippi River, for I have been there, yea, verily. You can drop a marble and it won't roll a lick. I mean, flat. It's called a floodplain for a reason. And interestingly enough, when the Mississippi River flooded so badly, a couple of years ago, they sent in Brinks trucks to evacuate the money from the casinos before they ever thought about evacuating any people. Got to save the money, boys. I don't care if you got to row it out. I don't care if you take it out on Huck Finn's raft. Save the money. In Tunica, Mississippi, men have a 66.7 average year lifespan, 73.3 for women. Just slightly better than what men and women have in McDowell County, West Virginia. I would submit that since there's no mountaintop removal in Tunica, Mississippi, maybe those extra years are that extra couple of years for, 2.8 years for men and just 0.4 of a year for women. Maybe that's accounted for by the almost constant fallout of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in the form of ultrafine particulates, as well as ultrafine silica, ultrafine coal, ultrafine, you get the idea. Might account for that. This is certainly a picture of income inequality. It is a picture of the real effect that poverty and unemployment has on one's life expectancy. It is interesting to me that in this entire article by Alex Henderson at Alternet, and a fine article it is, there is not one iota of reference to environmental toxins, or for that matter, that concept that is generally referred to as environmental justice, because of environmental justice in a place like McDowell County, or Mingo County, or Wyoming County, or Boone County, or Logan County, all of that, those places being part of the so-called southern coal fields, or in fact Fayette County, or in fact Raleigh County. There is no environmental justice. Because the only people talking about environmental injustice, which I think is even the concept of environmental justice is a little bit, not misleading, but misnomerish, human justice, perhaps. The only people talking about it are the marginalized people who dare to stand up against the thugs of the Friends of Coal or the West Virginia Coal Association. These massive health disparities are, of course, also part and parcel of the efforts going forward. My colleague, Bo Webb, is at present in Washington, D.C., trying to get some work done on the AIC Act. I haven't been there since July. He's carrying all the weight right now. And I'm telling you what, it's a hell of a weight to bear. But the AIC Act is predicated on the fact that we are being killed here, poisoned, that our lives are being shorn of years by these profiteering killers. Dr. John, with a question or an observation, he says, now, McDowell County, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's coal country, isn't it? It is, Dr. John, it is. I thought coal provided good jobs. Well, that's what they say, but it's not reality. There were 100,000 underground coal miners in this state in 1980. There are less than 14,000 of them now. And yet we're producing more coal in West Virginia than we were in 1980. That's because you can take a demolition crew running a couple of D9 cats and a drag line and a few huge dump trucks or so, and you, with 15 people, you can take down 5,000 acres in 5 years. That's progress. That's profit, baby. I thought coal raised standards of living, Dr. John says. Well, I mean, it sort of does if you're one of those very... There are less than 4,000 mountaintop removal workers in the state of West Virginia. And if you're one of those people, and you've got one of those $70,000 a year jobs, even though you're a high school dropout, well, you get a new truck every 5 years... your wife gets new bulbs for her tanning bed every year. You probably got a four-wheeler. You got the nicest double-wide they had on the lot. You probably got a safe full of guns for hunting season, even though it's getting harder and harder to hunt down there because there's less and less places for the deer and the turkeys and the rabbits and the squirrels to go be deer and turkeys and rabbits and squirrels because they'd starve to death on a mountaintop removal site. So, yeah, that's relative, that whole prosperity standard of living thing. John continues and says, I thought coal didn't poison communities. Or maybe it's the fact that extractive industries, mining or monocropping, and non-local, non-union jobs lower the base of wages. Without money, people rely on cheap, mass-produced food. Without social safety nets, people refuse medical treatment. Could it be that poverty kills? I think it could be, Dr. John. I think it could be. People in poverty don't have access to health care. Remember, if you've got so under the old Medicaid rules before the Medicaid expansion, of the Affordable Care Act, if you had a cardboard box to live in, they counted it as an asset, and, oh, I'm sorry, you can't have Medicaid. We learned that here the hard way. Dr. John continues, if that's the case, the good news is it's fixable. We can solve all those problems. But so long as people vote against their class interests, nothing will change. So long as people believe they're all disconnected individuals in competition with their neighbors, nothing will change. So long as people wait for pie in the sky when they die, nothing will change. And so, yes, while the optimistic view, Dr. John, is that this is fixable, the realistic view, based upon those last couple of things that you mentioned, especially the waiting for pie in the sky when they die part, nothing's going to change. That's not to say the efforts aren't being made. There are heroic efforts underway in places like Mingo and McDowell to change attitudes. There are wellness programs and programs that get people out and walking and trying to get them moving and just to try to offset some of these vastly negative influences. And I give them my praise for trying. But I also am not capable of ignoring glaringly obvious horrors in the room. How much good does going for a daily 1 mile walk do you when while doing said walking, you are, with every breath you take in, taking in ultrafine particulates that work on the subcellular level and just turn into little cancer factories in your bodies. Even if you don't smoke. Even if you don't like gravy with your gravy. Even if you've gotten up off your hind end, turned off Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child, and gotten out there and tried to do something. How long can you swim in poison? Even though swimming is good for you. And, of course, the numbers are not just out of Marin and Fairfax counties. The numbers are stark with a national comparison. According to the World Health Organization, factoring in both genders, the average life, overall average life expectancy in the United States is 79, 76 for females, 81 for 76 for males, 81 for females. 79. That's 4 years short of the 83 in Japan and Switzerland. In France, and Iceland and Spain and Italy and Australia and Canada and Israel and Luxembourg and Singapore and Sweden, it's 82. In Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, New Zealand, Finland, South Korea, the Republic of Ireland, and Norway, it's 81. In Belgium, Slovenia, the UK, Malta, Kuwait, and Portugal, it's 80. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. We're 27. We're 27. USA. 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 Greatest country in the world. But all of those European nations bring something else to mind. And that is this. At the time when those poor huddled masses yearning to breathe free left Europe, many of them were dirt poor, able to purchase some ticket in steerage and nothing else. sometimes one person coming to the United States and working like a draft animal and saving every spare cent to buy the next ticket. And then the next one, next family member comes over, and then the next one, and the next one, to rebuild a new life in the new world. And when they did, slowly, inexorably, surely, their life expectancy went up from a low it had existed at in the old country, where life had become very, very cheap. We are now in this country going backwards. Life expectancies will eventually drop to the levels of those people whose forebears left the same life expectancies for a better prospect here. It is telling. Oh gosh, am I missing something? I mean, did something momentous happen in the world today? Nah, I think we'll stick with this because this is pretty damned momentous. The mumblings and doings of the 1% manipulating the economy, yada, yada, yada. They don't much stack up against this very well, do they? But here's an interesting look from the other side of the coin. 100 years ago, when the average lifespan in the United States was something approaching 47 years, and that took into account people who died by their millions in the cesspits of unsanitary cities, where if you were not a Rockefeller or a Carnegie or a Mellon or a Walker or some other member of the predatory thug capital class, you were pretty much rolling the dice every day of your life, and you know, something like influenza or typhus or cholera or yellow fever could just rip through the tenements and decimate, well, more than decimate a place. At that time, and it's verified on tombstones out the road here, because, and I know it because I've sat there reading them and looking at them and ruminating on the fact that many of them are my relatives. At the time, and the same is true for much of rural America, I suspect. But at the time when people when the average lifespan for a man was not 50 years in this country 100 years ago, it's nothing to see entire cemeteries full of people in this area who lived into their 80s and their 90s. And that extends up into the 1930s or so. My grandmother, both of them, lived past 90 years old. One might argue that the quality of their life at the very end of their lives was nothing to write home about, but just in terms of sheer quantity, if not quality, they were long-lived. And so too had their forebears been, because they were eating foods that they raised themselves, that they had not dumped tons of industrial fertilizer on. The foods they were eating had not been genetically modified by the fine folks at Monsanto. Better eating through genetics. So what if our potatoes have the gene of a goat's stomach? Nothing wrong with that, nah. And oddly enough, these nonagenarians who fill up these cemeteries ate butter on everything. What they fried in lard. They ate more pig probably than anything else, with chicken a close second, and occasionally some beef. Not a lot of mutton. Not a lot of lamb. They ate deer until they just about reduced the deer population to zero. They ate rabbit. Yeah, some possum. Groundhog. An enterprising human can make a whole lot of different stuff that you and I would turn our noses up at pretty damn tasty in the long run. I think I was talking a few nights ago about my great-grandfather. He had orchards and grapevines and berry bushes. And then, of course, there were the blackberries and raspberries as big as your thumb that just grew wild here. And as long as you were willing to carefully walk about the berry patches and watch out for that cucumber smell that said, copperhead around here somewhere, and stay shy of the bear who was also gorging himself on the berries. Well, a cobbler made with fresh blackberries or fresh raspberries and a crust gently rolled out from just ever so little water and flour and lard, baked in an iron Dutch oven. Wow. And so while the rest of the country was dying before they got to 50, these people, living in rural America, living the rural American dream that Thomas Jefferson envisioned, literate, not wealthy in monetary terms, but landed to one degree or another, or even unlanded, having somewhere to live and ground to till, were about as successful as any generation of human beings that has ever, of white human beings, or European, and you can even to a certain extent add somewhat the African community into this, right. Now the difference being that before being stolen from Africa, the people who were brought here to be slaves for wealthy white people were living very successfully in their own lands. And to a decent age. This story, as much as any other, points out to me the absolute retrograde motion that is involved in these last, I hope, howling death throes of predatory capitalism. It may take a generation or two. But eventually, a hungry belly will make a hungry mind. And most people, as surprised as we might be to consider it, are not so silly as to constantly repeat the same old mistake, thinking that it is somehow going to yield a different result. Oh, and by the way, I think I saw a note in the email from Irish Dave saying, yeah, but that 63 number is pretty good for the third, so-called third world or developing world. Not so much. Those McDowell County men are barely ahead of Haiti and Ghana and Papua New Guinea, where the life expectancy for males is 62. Here's what's fascinating, however. The life expectancy of a man in McDowell County, West Virginia, is lower than the life expectancy of a male in Guatemala. Life expectancy for a man in Guatemala is 66. It is 63 in McDowell County, West Virginia. Kind of makes you wonder if any of our progressive heroes will be writing an article about this. Hey, Paul Krugman. Krugman. Hey, Robert Reich. Dean Baker. Bueller. 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 Yeah. Wonder how long before we get a really great speech from President Not Sure about the declining life expectancy of hillbillies. Even though it would probably be beneficial to do this from time to time where I live, I won't be holding my breath. Because, you know, freedom! I mean, we may only be here for 63 years, but them 63 free years. Oddly enough, Irish Dave and Dr. John lit on something at the almost the very same instant. Irish Dave with an email saying, speaking of tombstones, the West is full of graves marked died in childbirth. Two, also, infant mortality. And the very next email that came in was from Dr. John, who said, there's something lurking there. What pulls down life expectancy is infant mortality. So the fact is, those counties have high rates of infant mortality. Where are all those sanctity of life types when we're talking living humans rather than clusters of cells? Hint, nowhere to be found. Because see, while infant mortality is higher in a place like McDowell County and generally in West Virginia and generally in Appalachia, The right to life, people, the culture of life, people, while they've got an organization, they don't spend a lot of time worrying about places like McDowell, Mingo, Logan, Wyoming, Raleigh, Boone. No. Because for the most part, when a teenager gets pregnant in these counties, it is simply ingrained that the 10-year-old, the 11-year-old, the 12-year-old, the 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old little girl will simply give up on her education and have the baby that Jesus wants her to have. And because they themselves are children, and because access to medical care is so woefully inadequate in places like this, sometimes that cluster of cells becomes a baby that then dies upon birth. And we are some, to a certain extent, we are a macabre people here in Appalachia, because I'm going to try not to digress too far. But in the wake of the advent of the plague in Europe, art completely changed. And suddenly images of the Grim Reaper and death and skull motifs proliferated across the European artistic landscape. Something similar is taking place here. Now, where I live, when one of your loved ones dies in some godforsaken industrial accident, or gets incinerated alive for the sake of quarterly profit and loss statements in some godforsaken coal hole, or prosaically dies of cancer, God's will, the family responds by putting a big silhouette outline on the back window of their pickup truck. that declares to the world wherever they go that their pickup truck is in memory of Pappy, with born and died on the back window. And anybody who is within the sound of my voice who lives in this area, I know if they go out and about, have seen these very decals. There were 29 people incinerated in the Upper Big Branch disaster, and it is not unusual to see a car that says, in memory of, and a name, and then the letters UBB. Because for every one of those 29 who died, there were children, there were cousins, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, fathers, brothers, sisters, mothers, grandparents. And that is how we memorialize these horrors now here. I think I liked it better when we were just driving around with our favorite NASCAR driver's number on the car. Whew. Brutal. That's not just an exclamation. That is a statement of fact. It is brutal. And I'm sorry if I seem cynical for pointing out that I don't expect President Not Sure to be delivering any sort of stirring words about stop it in Appalachia. The last time anybody paid any attention to this area was somewhere between 1964 and 1968, and then Bobby got killed, and, well, what was he talking about? Who? Oh, them. Well, never mind. You get the idea. So I thought it more than appropriate that we address that issue going forward. And for now, however, we will go to the Skype line where Jeff has been waiting patiently. Are you still there, Jeff?
Sorry, sir.
Hello? Hello?
Hello, I'm sorry. I was in the other room.
Oh,
you did a great show. You talked from the bottom of your heart. It was really a good program. It was enjoyable to listen to it, and it was very educational. And I want to just tell you that.
Well, thank you.
And so anyway, but I'm only optimistic in one way, and the reason why we have this, the right to lifers are not there because they really give a damn about life. It's the PR games that keep people, it's all about the money thrown into these people to keep your mind, what they call limited hangouts. And until we actually, and the politicians are bought and paid for, you know, I know that. So, it's so difficult for me to listen to all these problems that I can see sort of answers for, but I don't think that going out and fighting with or beating up or getting bands of people together that I could possibly raise even in a lifetime to talk to my politicians to change the laws to stop blowing up mountains for money. I don't think we can do that if we stay within the same, realm of where we've been in for the past thousand or at least in this country.
Well, let's take a look at that real quick. I had occasion, this isn't Wednesday, but I do want to point this out. I had occasion to do some reading recently, and I recommended touching on the topic to Jude, our dear friend out in the Great Northwest. I was reading the complaints, and the only way they exist now is in the fact that they were quoted by an early church father by the name of Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. he quoted at length a philosopher of the ancient world by the name of Celsus, C-E-L-S-U-S. And Celsus had gone to great lengths to critique the fundamental problems with early Christianity and what it meant inside their culture. And he said one of the problems was that faith makes it all okay, and so you don't have to worry about anything anymore. And he said their philosophy is simple, simplistic, and dangerous. And he pointed out that it would ultimately, that if it grew, it would ultimately be the death of the Roman Empire, which it turned out he was quite correct. Well, none of that's changed in the last 2,000 years, Jeff.
I agree.
And so we see the manifestation of that in the problems we discuss from day to day here. That's not to say that is the principal cause, but it is a cause. But there are certainly other causes. Now, I for one don't believe, you sort of dismissed efforts to change laws rather blithely, I thought. But the fact of the matter is, it's the only thing we've got in a system that is composed of and grounded on laws. If you want to stop something, you gotta have a law to stop it.
Okay, you went back 2,000 years though. But the metrics over 2,000 years haven't changed. The real belief system is not the Christianity or Judaism or any of the religions. The real religion is the economic religion. And that needs, and you can't change that. You won't be able to change that. So you need to get it set up so the laws work for within the economic system, so you don't blow up mountaintops, so you make life worthwhile, you give people an opportunity to educate themselves, you give them less hours of work, you allow them to have good food, which is clean air, clean water, and clean calories, and you allow them a safe place to live. You can't do that within the economic matrix belief system. That's why I don't dismiss the laws. I just believe that the laws are within the metric systems that create the politicians who create the laws.
But Jeff, wait just a second, because in talking about those old ones of my former generations, they may have been living close to something that you're describing. My great grandfather was a farmer. He was literate. At least enough to get by and read the Bible. You know, I'm sure he was no theologian, but he could read the Bible to his children every night, and he made sure that every last one of them were as literate as any human being in this area. Okay? Now, he was a farmer. He worked his ass off. That's how come he was able to eat all of those calories and eat all of that fat and live into his 90s. Okay? Now, compare him with my other great-grandfather. My other great-grandfather was a part of the rising, thus far, nascent middle class. All right? He was a section boss for the C&O Railroad. He literally had a big hand in doing what people told Collis P. Huntington could not be done. That is, lay a railroad through the New River Gorge of what is now West Virginia. He died at 60 or 61, working in industrial circumstances around, I am sure, industrial toxins for a wage. He was, without a doubt, wealthier than my other great-grandfather. And yet my other great-grandfather, poorer though he was working only for himself and worked as much as he needed to work in order to feed the people in the little cultural unit that mattered to him, i.e. his family.
Right.
Oddly enough, he had asthma. And every year, I have this directly from my grandmother, his firstborn child of his second marriage, that as soon as she was able, she would go out, as soon as she was old enough to do anything, she was out in the fields with him, helping him with the reaping and bringing in the wheat and bringing in the corn. And as each child, male or female, got old enough to do so, they were out there with Poppy again. Or also. And if you work by the seasons, you know, we've got that old saying, make hay while the sun shines. Well, that, I mean, it's bounded and grounded in reality, because you cannot make hay in the nighttime because the dew will rot your hay. You got to make hay while the sun shines, so that the hay can dry out and can be baled or stacked or whatever means you're using to preserve it to feed your animals through the long and dark and unprosperous winter. But the thing about that long, dark, and unprosperous winter, Jeff, is that leisure time actually goes up.
That's right. No, Susan's actually reading a book about that, but I want to have you know, we live in a, it used to be 40, we moved here 40 years ago, it's a farm country. And I've met a lot of farmers and they work quite hard, milkers and also dairy cows, but small dairy cows, like 100 acres, compared to not the dairy cows like you see in Texas or Florida. But they're small dairy cows. And someone said to me, look at that poor guy driving the old pickup truck. I said, I have never in my life met a poor farmer. And I meant that seriously. They don't have any money, but their families are fed. They live a quality of life that's great. And now the economy has pushed most of these farmers out. I think there's two out of maybe there was 40 farms when I first got here. So they're literally squeezing the system is squeezing out because of tax structures. So you have to sell out to the big guys. The system is obviously a problem. But I'm not suggesting that. But I'm not at all disagreeing with your what you're saying. I have a lot of faith in what can be done, not as what is being done. But the faith I have in what can be done is not a religious faith. I believe by just listening to Howard Zinn or listening to some great scholars who talked about what has happened, that there is, I don't believe we can change it within this, and I hate to use the word metrics, but or I can't think of a different word, but since the Roman Empire, or even prior to that, the economic system has always been askewed to kill the slaves that are not worth anything. And for a short time in this country, for a very short time in this country, because just by happenstance, the tax structure was set up just by mistake. It wasn't figured out. The tax structure was set up where you had a really great fighting chance. So the whole world looked at us as a beacon, a great light. But when Reagan changed that tax structure, that totally changed the whole complexion of things. And I'm not, so that means that once the tax structure changed, the Koch brothers can well afford to buy and make the laws. The ones who control the purse strings don't care what laws are made. They control the money, or they control the economy. And the economy is a belief system. It's not a real system. Money is not real. Labor and intellect is real. So what we need to do is put a value on that somehow, somewhere, some mathematician, a scientist has to put a value on a human life that we can set into a metric system that.
I understand that. I understand what you're talking about. I think I'm more confused by the idea or perhaps perplexed than even you are. But I think I don't know, Jeff, maybe we have to drill down one level further, and that is to contemplate what value means. In saying that, you know, we've seen those studies that come out periodically that show that people in Denmark, for instance, are happier than anybody on the planet, or people in Iceland, and they are routinely places you would not look to as being the happiest places on earth. But, you know, you can't, as I think Dr. John has alluded, you can't measure happiness or freedom by how many...
I gotta bring this out. I cannot give you the pursuit of happiness. I can give you education, food, and shelter within the economic system and use that as a minimum a minimum living thing. When you
I'm not even sure, Jeff, that pursuit of happiness is effective anymore, because I think that may be, or at least I think we should question it, because
I am questioning
for instance, if you are educated, happiness is going to be much more difficult to get at.
Oh no, I agree.
Maybe I'm dead wrong here, because but with education comes the ability to question, and with questioning comes discontent, and with discontent comes the yearning to make things better.
You are cursed with the burden of truth. That's the way I look at it. When you educate yourself, in some cases, you are cursed with the burden of truth. You now have the truth. I am just suggesting that there's enough natural resources in this world that you don't have to blow off the top of coal mines. You don't have to frack. There's enough natural resource in this world to give everybody, for a minimum 20 hours of whatever they want to do, be it a doctor or a ditch digger, food, shelter, and specifically education. Now, after that, your free market can kick into play, so the insanities, they want to make $1 million an hour, go to it, baby, enjoy. But I'm saying there's a minimum quality of life. Now, once you've got the food, shelter, and education as a minimum, worldwide, minimum, then you have the right to, if you want to think that you love music and you're happy with that, fine. But I've known the money doesn't make you happy. You don't have, no one could give you whatever in your mind. Only the nose knows what the beak seeks. But I'm just trying to suggest that I would love to see all this nonsense. I went to a conference last night, and it was about the Audubon Society. The Audubon Society was talking about 501c3s and RPI. And she was getting out there and saying, well, we partner, when we get grants, we try to go to we think big. And we think that clean coal is a great answer, and we think that nuclear power is a great answer. And I'm looking at this woman up there, and I'm saying, this is the Audubon Society that I used to belong to for 40 years. And I haven't done 5 years, but I'm looking at this woman speak. They're bought and sold by the extractive industries. They're bought and paid for. This is unbelievable to look to see.
Well, you know, you remind me of an old anecdote, Jeff, and I'm sure that to the weird little right-wingers that listen to this program and occasionally send crappy notes and things like that, that they will run, you know, they'll run screaming, jumping up and down and making their strange little monkey noises when I mention this. But what you reminded me of is an anecdote about Che Guevara. It was said that after the success of the Cuban Revolution, that Che would, of course, he achieved this celebrity status, and journalists wanted to talk to him, and they wanted to ask him, questions about the revolution and how could the revolution spread and blah, 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 blah. And most of these people were internationals, and they were elites. And they wanted him to sit down in a chair, and they wanted to stick microphones and cameras in front of his face, and they wanted him to pontificate. Instead, however, he was a real revolutionary. And of course, there are lots of people who spit on the ground at the mention of his name. I'm not one of them. But instead of sitting there patiently for the for-profit elites to go back and, do a story in life or whatever, he would say, okay, I'll answer any question you've got. Come with me. And he would take them out to the cane fields, and he, Che Guevara, would get a machete in his hand and begin to chop sugar cane. And he would point out to them along the way that in his vision of the revolution, there was no room for somebody who wanted to just sit around and think. That there had to be a lot of doing, and of course, this is a manifestation of the line from the book of James that says, "Faith without works is dead." You can sit around and talk about the glorious revolution and the coming dictatorship of the proletariat, but if you don't sweat to make it happen, it ain't gonna happen.
You need both. You need brawn and brain to make humanity work. You got to have both, and one's not worth that much more than the other. You're preaching my song, man. I mean, this is where I'm coming from. You need brains to think about what you want to do, but once you think about it, you've got to do it. You just can't sit back and say, "Hey, baby, this is a great idea. Let someone else do it." Now you've got to go forward with it. And I'm agreeing with it. We have to change the system. I'm just trying to figure out. I don't want to keep on spinning my wheels. And I spent 20 years lobbying Congress and Senate. I spent 20 years lobbying New York State to get renewable energy. That moved because it was a sensible thing to do. But I went, and the big guys got into it. Nowadays, you can rent solar panels in New York State for $100 less than your electric bill, and 20 years later, you own them. What they did is they used the sun to make their 6 or 8% interest because they're only going to get 1% in the bank.
Yeah, so, well, you know, I just got a couple of tweets in. One from Sandra, who started out by who simply said, "You know, money helps." And then Isaac followed up and said, "I have never met an unhappy rich person or one that wanted to be poor." And both of those are true. I mean, if we're going to live in a world where exchange on some level is the grease on the wheels of existence, then we've got to, you know.
But that's the problem with the game. The problem is that if you had a minimum living.
Well, I see one of the fundamental problems as being not so much trade, but the fact that we value speculation over actual production.
Oh, look at it this way. How could it possibly be that a physicist or a researcher in a lab makes $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year if they're lucky with all the education they have, and a guy pushing buttons on Wall Street and playing the market is making $50-60 million a day?
Precisely what I just said. We value speculation over production.
Exactly. So, but there's the only way I could see to change that way the system's worked for 2,000 or 3,000 years, and this is, it has been working that way. It's just that it's gotten pronounced. It's been amplified in the last 20, 30, 40 years since Reagan changed the tax structure. But it hasn't been amplified since 3,000 years prior to that. It's about the same. So what I'm saying is, because there's never been a measurement, we guessed at something, but until you can measure something, you can't tell me how to get from where we are to there. So I'm looking at a scientific way of saying one human being has a base. They have so many calories a year that they eat water and food. Let's use that as a base. Then let's say you have 12 years of education and you're a popular person, so you're worth 12, maybe 14 times more. If you make a million times more, here's how you got to put back. So once you start figuring that number out, then it's no longer profitable for them to blow the tops of mountains off. It's no longer profitable for people to kill people for profit. It stops. The whole game changes. And by the way, I love listening to the way you talk about these things. That's why it's like you're like a magnet. And I love the topic you're talking about. Unfortunately, I find it very, very saddening. But the reason why I find it saddening is I'm trying to find a way to get that change the same way you are, but I'm looking at it from I'm just going to say a different point of view.
I think you're approaching it from kind of like Einstein working to find his unified field theory, where everything worked on the macro and the micro level in the same way. Me, I guess I take a more I'm probably not entitled or even competent to use this phrase on. Circumstances, but I guess I take a more anthropogenic or anthropological look, because all this system has collapsed sooner or later. Now but the question is, how did they collapse? Some collapsed of their own weight. Some collapsed because of external pressures. The demarcation between the two, perhaps being, for instance. The collapse of native civilizations in the Americas that was brought on by the arrival of white Europeans versus the collapse of various and sundry European Eurasian civilizations simply because they exhausted their resources, their ruling elite became entirely predatory upon the production class. There's any number of those things, but the end result is that I know these things ultimately fail.
Right.
Every one of those fail
because they were the beginning of the economic system has always been, and I will not believe that my history, the history teaches me that history repeats itself. No, I have enough confidence in human beings that history will not repeat itself again. If we think of a way, we have the first time in history, we can now measure calories, we can measure BTUs, we can measure joules. If we can change that, if we can just put that simple measurement in place, we will change, it's going to change history. It will not keep on repeating. If we don't put that measurement in place, history is doomed to repeat itself.
Anyone who posits a new idea must deal with the fact that it's possible it will not catch on. So then the question becomes, what kind of things do we put in place to be ready when the collapse happens? I don't know if capitalism is going to collapse in 50 years or 75 years or 100 or 200 or 500, but I'm pretty sure it will. And the problem then becomes, do we have something written down? Do we have something recorded? Do we have something that people can use as a guide, a pull star for rebuilding? Because if you look at fracking, if you look at the tar sands that are the genesis of the whole idea of the Keystone XL pipeline and all these other filthy pipelines, if you look at mountaintop removal, if you look at the poisoning of the Pacific, if you look at the poisoning of the Gulf, if you look at the deforestation and the defishing of the sea, what you find out is that all of these things are happening for one reason and one reason only, Jeff. They're happening because of capitalism.
Capitalism
is eventually going to eat itself, because capitalism fails to take into account the fact that Earth itself is a closed loop.
But another ism, unless we understand, just like we understand temperature or size or weight, until we put something in, it doesn't matter what ism you put in, capitalism will definitely fail. I have no doubt about it, and probably within our lifetime, and we're old. But the other
easy field, with that we, Kemosabe.
But the thing is, another ism will take its place, and they may say, "Oh, it's time to go to socialism, or it's time to go to communism." The isms are irrelevant. If you don't have a measurement in place for what a human being is worth for their base life working time, which should not be forever, it should be maybe 3 or 4 hours a day to do what you feel is right, that you can help somebody with. Most people will work more than that. Most people will work hard because they want to. If you look at the Venus Project or the resource-based economy, they make quite a bit of sense, but I don't know how to get from there to there without the measurement. I'm saying to you that I have enough confidence in humanity that if we can just wake up people enough to say what's going on now is not right, and they know it's not right, and we need to figure out a way to make it so you show, you are worth, you as a human being who is working in that mine shouldn't be allowed to die for your money. You shouldn't be able to die for that job. You are worth something. You who wants to play a music instrument is worth as much as the doctor who wants to do.
And you know what? We need to be careful, Jeff, lest we make the terrible blunder of acting as though the United States is exactly like the rest of the world. We're describing problems in the United States and much of the developing world. We're no longer a so-called first world country here. I think the life expectancy numbers bear some of that out. But there are countries where they're getting things like this right. Look at the Scandinavian countries. Look at Finland, where doctors and elementary school teachers earn an almost equivalent wage, and neither the doctors nor the teachers are pissed off at the other because they both recognize the worth of the other inside the larger social system.
Just look at Cuba. Cuba is an example of that. Unfortunately, there's other problems. But I'm suggesting to you that it can't be done on a one-country basis. It has to be a worldwide accepted measure.
You know what? If you wait for it to be a worldwide movement, you're going to be waiting a very long time, Jeff. Somebody, whether it's on a neighborhood level, a city block level, or a county level, or a state level, or a country level, or even a global level, some element within that country or some element within that community, whether it be global or neighborhood, somebody's got to go first.
That's right.
And so, I mean, if you just as an example, look at the change, the rise in changing technologies for the making of stone tools. Somebody discovered it first,
right.
and then it was adopted, not because, oh look, that's lovely, that is a positively magnificent point. Come here, old boy, come here. Isn't this a lovely point?
They did it because it
functioned, because it worked, because it was better.
But the measurement, the collective unconscious will move forward this measurement just like they did with foot, inches, or metrics. The collective unconscious, Bob, moves this forward. It starts every little group. We have groups starting all over the world now. I have people in Indonesia, in Philippines, in India. There's little groups starting up all over the place now. It's starting to move, but it's going to be the collective unconscious moves it forward.
But I'll tell you, Jeff, this is a little bit of what scares me about your theoretical framework. Because human beings are human beings.
Right.
And because we are far more chimpanzee-like than bonobo-like, I can envision a situation where, let's say it's some sort of authoritarian regime, and they come by and they look at your little punch card or your little, or they scan your little magnetic stripe or perhaps the chip in your neck, and they say, oh, goodness me, this is the third month that you have not lived up to your caloric capacity. Off to the death camp for you.
Oh, no. You sound like a right-winger.
No, that's not. How dare you? I mean, no, that's not. Authoritarian regimes are not limited in either space or time. And anytime you reduce human nature to a number, then we have a way of becoming the number and becoming less human in the process.
This is not what we're told you. This is not it. You are trying to move the collective unconscious forward to change a law. I'm saying to you, without a measurement, and a matter of fact, Gates brought something out in his last letter. He brings out a letter a year. He said, without a measurement, nothing can move forward. I agree with that. I'm not saying that you're going to be have a chip in your head and you remember and you get you get your that's not at all. If I came across like that, that has nothing to do with what I'm suggesting at all. If human beings have a tendency, you can stop people from wanting to do something. Some people are more ambitious than others. Some people are not. But I'm sorry that I came across like I wanted to be.
Well, no, it's not how you came across. It's just my mind trying to work within the framework. I tend not to look at how things can work in their best case scenario. I look for the way that things fall apart. You know, William Butler Yeats said, the center cannot hold. What happens when the center doesn't hold? Pol Pot.
You can have a donut.
Or the Great Leap Forward, or the forced re-agrarianism of a Stalin, a Stalinist movement. You can't necessarily force people onto the land, but the contrary to that, Jeff, is that there's a real problem when capitalism forces people off the land, like what you were talking about with the diminution of family farms.
But don't you see? It's not the ism. It's it's inhumane. It doesn't matter whether it's socialism, capitalism. It doesn't matter what the ism is. It's inhumane system, and we need to figure out some kind of a humane system, and you can't do it within the confines of the economic system. It can't be done. Of course, there's never been a measurement for it. And once you see that, once you step back and you realize the monetary system is run by the economic system, it's a separate system. When you realize the political system is run, the educational system is one. Any system is all is run by the economic system. The economic system is a belief system, just like people believe in God, and it's not real. So if you can't get out of that system, I can opt out of my religion. I can't opt out of the economic system. So therefore, I must figure out a way to make the economic system work fairly for humanity. So that's the point of what I think and other people I'm working with now is trying to do, and we just keep on plugging away to try to get the collective unconscious to move forward, and we try to do more and more radio and television. We try to talk to people from all over the world. Each one start their own group. Don't join us. Just talk about this issue. Get it out there. There's a problem, and both right and left understand there's a horrendous problem, but the right and left blame one another. We're saying, no, it's not that. It's something more than that. Look, step back and stop blaming one another and go forward. And I don't think we need to chip in someone's forehead to see if they work there 4 hours a day. I think it just, once you understand that you do anything, take care of your child. You're going to get your education, food, and shelter. You don't need the measurement for the four hours. That's, as a human being, that's your inalienable.
You have a far greater degree of faith, Jeff, in human nature than I do. because my understanding of history is almost at direct odds with what you're suggesting.
That's the problem. I believe that. We keep on repeating history. I'm saying to you, if we can.
But it's not. It's not a persistent repetition. If you drill down, you'll find that history is a series. Yeah, there are mistakes that are made over again, but there are also advances. I mean, fire, please, the wheel, stone tool technology. Then copper, then bronze, then iron, then steel, then carbon nanofibers.
But that's not a measurement for humanity. That's how great humanity is. They move forward, and what's happened over the years as
but you can also ask the question whether that is actually progress, because we know. I mean, this is not speculative. We know that a member of the San people has more leisure time than some guy, some nuclear family in middle America that's working themselves into an ugly early grave. If you took John and Jane Sixpack and moved them into the Kalahari, they would probably die for simple lack of television exposure. But that doesn't, there's a relativism in what it means to have leisure and what one does with it. If one is composing tunes on a flute that was made from the bone of an ostrich leg, who's to say that is less valuable leisure than sitting parked in front of a television watching Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Cha?
No, no, that is not, that's not the point I'm making. I'm agreeing with you. You probably had better quality of life many, many years ago. I'm not going to go into, but what I'm saying is that I'm not the one who says what's good leisure or good quality. I'm saying if you work 20 hours or 15 hours doing whatever you need to do, if you need to take care of your kid, that qualifies. If you need to, whatever it is, you get education, part of your inalienable right as a human being, as a living human being, you have education, food, and shelter. Then, after that, your free market, if you want to call it that, kicks in. That means you've gotten money, which is now in the way, is out of the way. Now, if you choose to go ahead and expound on a radio station, your basics are taken care of. If you decide you want to listen to music, you can do that. I'm not telling you, I don't ever want to say to someone, you're not doing it right, or you may be doing it differently than I would do it, but if you believe in what you believe in, hey baby, go do it. But I'm saying that the problem is not whether fire helped us, or the automobile helped us, or coal helped us or not. I'm saying to you that we need to start looking at human beings as a minimum measurement for every human being around the world. And once you've gotten that minimum change, that fundamental basic change in humanity will change the whole economic system. And once you've changed the economic system, your political system starts to work. Your educational system starts to work. Every system in the world gets to be changed over because of this simple equation. And you don't have to kill people for that equation. You don't even have to lobby for that occasion. All you've got to do is bring to light. I was talking to an Apple computer guy today. I had a problem with the computer. And he looked on my computer and he saw the work we're doing. He said, that's interesting. And I said, yeah, and I talked to him about it. I got the nicest letter from this Apple guy saying, that was the most interesting thing I've seen in years. So, and I didn't have to preach at him. He got it. He's a smart guy, educated. So I'm killing myself. I make good money, he says, but I don't have time. I don't have enough time to see my kid. So, but I'm saying, you see where I'm going with that. I don't think it's going to be, as long as they don't close down the internet, I think we have a fighting chance to get around the world with this thing. I just think once the measurement comes into the place, if we can get it done fast enough, mountaintop removal will cease. Oil drilling will pretty much cease. As long as you have enough basic fuels to go ahead and build the renewable industries, it'll happen. Technologies will come about that we've never even thought of because you took the profit motive pretty much out of the game. That's the way I believe. Maybe I'm totally crazy, but I think that I have confidence in that.
Well, you know what, Jeff? The world needs its idealists, and I think you are definitely one of them. and I gotta give you props for that. In the meantime, I'm going to roll on because you've got a whole bunch of lines lit up, and you've definitely inspired a conversation this evening.
Hey. Thank you by now.
All right. Take care, Jeff. Bye. Calling from, I think New York. That's Jeff. And I don't know. I don't know if there's something wrong with my brain. I guess I take a dimmer view of human nature. Let's go to the phones. 304-658-3333. And it looks like lines are rolling over, so that's a real bonus. Here we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how about those DT commercials?
Oh, Jesus. Making life better. Yeah, the Gulf is a wonderful place. It's better in Louisiana. No, Mississippi.
I haven't seen one in probably 3 weeks up here in Vermont. But Malloy just read those couple articles last night about the horror and the shock that was predicted by scientists back when BP magically made the oil disappear, which they didn't. They sank it.
And it
sounds like it's starting to really come true.
Well, you know, what struck me, I was listening to Jeremy, and he was reading from the one that just got all over me was the one by Dar Jamal. because several years back, my friends down at Seneca 2, which is an activist progressive group down in the Kanawha Valley, they had Dar Jamal come speak. And I was privileged to be there and had a little conversation with him. And this was immediately post BP spill, and he was telling, he made his chops, Jeremy, reporting on the unreported horrors of the Iraq War, and right. You know, he saw, for instance, the terrible birth defect clusters that came from our use of depleted uranium, white phosphorus, you know, what we did to, you know, Fallujah is just one big birth defect cluster now, so he went from there to the Gulf Coast and began seeing similar horrors, which I think speaks to my theory that the United States is no longer a so-called first world nation. And I remember him telling one story, and it's way back in the archive somewhere, but he told one story about a young, perfectly healthy 20-year-old man, or 20-something young man, very athletic, who would go out and swim in the ocean every day. That was his means of maintaining his health. After the BP spill, he swam out one day, maybe a month later. He's dead. And he's dead of the toxins rolling through his body. And hearing that last night, among other things, reminded me that I need to invite Dar Jamal up here to Appalachistan so that, you know, he can do some reporting from here too.
Yeah, I was listening to that last night, amongst other things that he was saying, and I became slowly more and more enraged over the whole subject. I smell a dead rat a long time ago when they started running those commercials, and lo and behold, now that some of these papers are coming out and people are saying the contrary, it looks like they're rolling back some of those commercials.
Yeah. Well.
They were saying that oil is coming up in as far as Clearwater, Florida. It's showing up in the Gulf and stuff, so yeah, it's just I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
When you run across information like Dar Jamal's article, it's hard not to just let your being be overwhelmed with hatred. You know, from remember the CEO of BP who said, I just want my life back. From him all the way down. And then, just as a foodie, so, quote unquote, I kind of hate that word. You know, I hate the people. I hate them for fucking up the oyster beds. Okay, I do. Because you know, the vast majority of pleasures, 9 times out of 10, are simple ones, Jeremy. Like what Jeff was talking about. When my grandmother was approaching her 90th year and could still tell me about her daddy, my great grandfather. The same one I was talking about with Jeff, and how he would drink a glass of, and I've still got his goblet that he drank it out of. He would drink a goblet of warm sugar water, peel an apple, give slices of apple from his orchards to his children, read them the Bible, and play them the banjo. And when my grandmother described that, I don't think I ever heard her describe something with as much pleasure as the pleasure that came from that moment. And you could not pay for that with all the money that the BP asshole has. Now, he could hire a banjo player, he could hire a Bible reader, he could probably buy apples from the best orchard in England. But he's not going to have that experience. On the other hand, I have to temper it with the reality of what Sandra and Isaac pointed out, that you don't run into a lot of miserable rich people. So where's the middle ground, Jeremy?
I don't know, but you don't run into a lot of miserable rich people because they don't have to live in the same reality the rest of us do. They live in a land where if your water gets polluted, you can truck it in from 100,000 miles away, or you just fly somewhere else till it's polluted there. I don't know what the middle ground is, but definitely you hear stories like that that conflict with what they're trying to put out, really just boil your blood. Just for the sake of people, it's going to affect as far north as even Vermont and Maine at some point.
Sure. It's not just going to lay there.
No, no. It's going to keep coming up, and I mean, I'm always brought back to the, I can't think right now, the Exxon Valdez. They're still getting oil coming up on those beaches there. And Exxon still hasn't paid a dime of their, I think at the time it was like a $20 million, maybe even less. It might have been a $2 million fine. They still haven't paid a penny of it. It's been 20 years.
Right. And remember, you know, Exxon went crying to the court that their punitive damages were too high. That jury punished us too much. You know, we're Exxon. And the thugs, you know, the rats went, absolutely. Poor little Exxon.
I remember in...
And Prudhoe Bay is still a wreck.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, I remember in middle school or high school, which is decades ago now, I did a project on the rainforest. And I remember I came across one picture of these oil barrels stacked pretty tall, like as wide as a house, as tall as a house. And on one of them, there's still the marking of Exxon, but there's oil bubbling out of these all over the place, just destroying the rainforest. So... oil's been doing the damage for 100 years now.
Yeah.
But I don't have a terrible lot to say. I thought I'd bring that up since I hadn't heard it yet, really mentioned other than by Malloy, that one article.
And, the other article that Malloy mentioned, the guy sailing across the Pacific, I happened to run across something a couple of years ago, and it was some sort of environmental thing. And the guy was sailing across the Pacific himself, and he made the same observations this guy did. That in sailing across the Pacific before, he had seen flying fish, and he'd seen, you know, whales and dolphins, and you could always just throw a line out and, you know, dinner. And he said, that's gone. It's gone.
And now it's replaced with floating chimneys from Fukushima.
Right, or you know, vast... atolls of plastic grocery bags and six-pack and you know the six-pack collars.
Yeah, there's a Malloy mentioned that at the very end of that segment, that how much it made him mad when the cruise guys told him what it was he was looking at. There's a spot, I believe it's in the Atlantic Ocean, that's the size of Texas. That's one of those kind of floating landfills.
Yeah, it is the size of Texas, and it's not the only one.
Right, there's six or seven throughout the seas.
And the thing is, you know, I'm stuck between the concept of, my old buddy used to say, "Free your mind, your ass will follow." individuals taking individual action that, you know, the whole bumper sticker thing of think globally and act locally. Okay. Great, good idea. But we have problems now that cannot be individually solved. They are massive problems caused by massive systems, and it's going to take some sort of a massive system to fix them. I mean, how do you get a world convention on not putting our effing plastic garbage bags in the ocean? Maybe that starts with a world convention on not having plastic effing grocery bags.
Right.
And go from there. But, you know, God forbid there should be a plastic effing grocery bag bill introduced in the Congress of the United States. Everybody from the American Enterprise Institute to the Competitive Enterprise Institute to the Heritage Foundation to the Cato Institute to the Southern Baptist Convention would issue encomia saying, "Oh, this is creeping communism. The free market economy depends on our freedom to make plastic effing grocery bags."
You know it's true, Bob. You know it's true, unfortunately. Freedom, you know, Wolverines.
Yeah. I didn't even have to say it this time. You guys are doing it for me. By the way, you'll get it. I know you wander around on my Facebook page. Scroll down and find what Carl did last night. He found... I showed it to Agnes, and we both just sat there laughing. He found a picture of some Wolverines, and he put a speech bubble outside one of them's mouth saying "Freedom," and the other Wolverine's got a speech bubble saying "Us."
No. I was involved in that little post over the weekend, and thought I could throw in the 2 cents about being, you know, having my life threatened, all this other stuff, and not being a hunter. I still don't have a gun. I have no need for one. I really don't.
Right.
I don't fear for my life from a 6'2".
Yeah.
Saudi Arabian, whatever, falling around, you're going to bomb me all the time. It's not going to happen.
No.
So yeah.
And you know, the other thing that doesn't that doesn't get mentioned a lot, because anytime I do recognize the distinction when we're talking about firearms, Jeremy. I recognize the distinction between hunting and sporting arms and handguns. Okay.
Yes, so do I.
It's a huge distinction, and I have much less animus against, you know, the family 12 gauge than I do against the family 44 mag or the family 19 round 9mm pistol. But the fact of the matter is, and we do have to acknowledge this, and I'd just like to point it out again, I've said it before, there are not enough wild animals in this country to sustain a subsistence, I kill what I eat, hunting population. That's why we have hunting seasons. That's why it is a sport and not a lifestyle. And in point of fact, I think we should acknowledge that hunting is damned well something that you cannot do without a sizable amount of privilege glowing off of you. Okay? I mean, there's the old joke about the little city kid who had gone out to the country to summer camp for the first time, writing his parents, begging them to let him come back home to the city, because he was writing, he was in his tent at night, and he said, I've been bitten by ants, and I've been stung by bees, and I've been getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. And then he sees a firefly come into his tent, and he says, oh my God, Mama, they're coming after me with flashlights now. And so, you know, unless one has a fairly vast amount of wealth, one is not going to be leaving one's urban stronghold to go out and stalk Bambi in Bucks County. I mean, it just isn't going to happen. You know, deer season, antlered deer season here runs for 2 weeks, and it starts the Monday before Thanksgiving. And there is always the obligatory newspaper article, Jeremy, about the West Virginia economy will receive $55 million from hunters going out to chase Bambi. Well, then it's, you know, it's sport, it's economic activity, it is privilege. You know, hunting rifles ain't cheap. You can buy yourself a Freedom Protekin pistol a hell of a lot cheaper than you can buy your, I mean, I used to have them. I sold them all off when we had children. I really did. But I had some magnificent weapons. I had some magnificent hunting rifles. I'm a terrible shot. That's another reason I quit hunting. One of my old buddies used to say that he said, Bob, I was out in the yard the other day, and I heard a couple of deer talking about you. I said, really? What'd they say? He said, well, I heard an old buck talking to a young buck, and he said, listen, if you see that Kincaid guy out with his rifle, stand perfectly still. If you stand perfectly still, he can't hit you. If you start moving, however, he might eventually walk one into you. The guy can kill you quicker with a typewriter and a piece of paper than he can with a rifle. Just don't move. So there was
also
So that played into it. But I mean, you know, my favorite rifle was a Remington 300 Mag Browning with a synthetic stock and a stainless steel barrel, you know, laid onto a glass beaded bed with a 4.5x4 Leupold scope, 4.5x14 Leupold scope. I mean, you know, I was into the culture for a little bit, and you know, and I was in an occupation that made it a rather intelligent move for me to keep a handgun on me as much as possible. And it creeped me the F out. And so I got away from that. And the only thing, you know, full disclosure, the only thing left here is a shotgun.
I have friends who have to feel they have to be strapped all the time, too, and I've never understood it. I understand it. I mean, I understand hunting, but we still get the story, maybe not every year, but every couple of years, about a hunter who shot a deer 100 feet out of a tree. And up in the tree, I should say, not out of the tree. He shot a deer up in a tree, swore it was a deer, and when it hit the ground, it was a human being dead on contact.
Aye.
We've had that happen at least twice in the last 10 years. And usually the person who does the shooting, of course, is jacked up on liquor or something else, so it's usually deemed an accidental homicide. They still go to jail, but all in the name of good fun and sports. But I'll let you go, because I don't really hold up those stale smoke talk.
No, I understand that. Jeremy, have yourself a good evening. I appreciate the call. It's always a good conversation.
You too. Thanks, Bob.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. Your first caller took me back many, many years when I sat and discussed the same stuff with people 40 years ago or more. And how if we all pulled together and if we did blah, 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 which is he's right. But try to get some of these people who can't get enough money, who can't get enough this, they can't get enough that. Bob, I couldn't get enough tools so that I didn't have to pay somebody else to change my damn oil or some other ridiculous thing. Because, you know, money was for putting away, because the racket I was in, you never knew when it would come to a stop. And I was grew up poor, Bob. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I grew up in a housing project in a Catholic children's home. Nothing because I something I didn't do anything wrong either. I didn't want to attend major work classes at their behest.
Right.
And travel by public transportation. They didn't have private school buses in the city in those days. And I just took a resentment against the power structure. Hell, I was only 9 years old, and I didn't like the power structure kicking me in the ass and telling me what I had to do. I'd read too much about freedom. Maybe that's why I was a sympathizer with the Confederacy when I was 9 years old. Because the freedom aspect that they yacked about and they talked about, which then I began to find out the freedom was theirs and screw everybody else. And I mean really screw everybody else, you know?
Righteously.
Well, I read
thoroughly.
Fletcher Pratt's Short History of the Civil War, and he was so damn nasty about the secessionists that it changed my mind completely. But so the first caller, I agree with the theory, but how in the hell can you bend enough minds when the people don't have a freaking mind? You know, they don't understand what the guy's talking about. I mean, I've known people that my second wife, she couldn't buy enough of clothes and crap like that. Clothes to me were jeans and a flannel shirt, and I liked skier's underwear if I was out fishing in the late fall before the rivers froze. Because those things, you ever wear those things?
No, I don't think I'm familiar.
Polypropylene.
Yeah.
It wicks the water away from you. You don't get cold because you know the old fashioned underwear, man. You'll sweat like a pig in there, and there's nothing like water on your body when it's zero outside. I just wish we could organize more people along the lines that he's talking about. But, Bob, it takes a certain type of thinking to do that. My kind of thinking is, I don't care what anybody else does as long as it's not in my living room, you know?
Right.
That's, you know, it's their business. Whatever they want to do. But I'll give you a couple of quick news stories. One that passed through last night. A 90-year-old U.S. Army veteran who had an audience and an apology from the current Japanese emperor. He was a Bataan death march survivor, this old guy. And that gratified me, that the Japanese emperor could go through the... Even if he was only going through the motions, that was quite a thing to do. To apologize to this man for what happened to those gentlemen. And another quick story. The United States shipped a bunch of those Stuart tanks, which was the lightest tank we had in those days. Look at that 38-millimeter cannon. That's how light it was. And they shipped them to the Philippines. And one of the escort ships convoying them, because I didn't know about this. This is about the third time I've been through this book, and I finally heard about it. That's how audiobooks are, Bob. Kind of know that. Well, one of the ships that convoyed this load of tanks from Hawaii was the USS Arizona.
Wow.
Yeah, my God, I was shocked. But so much of what I just heard tonight is the same stuff we talked about in the 60s, and things were going to get, if we worked at it, we could make things better, but there are people in this society who they cannot get enough of anything. Be it my second wife who couldn't, Bob, we had five dogs and two cats, and she goes out and buys white carpeting. Okay. I mean, I didn't say anything, and she put the carpet down on it.
White carpeting is so beautiful for the first 5 seconds after it's been laid.
I also had a steam cleaner and a floor scrubber and the scrubbed rugs that I bought. Well, I'm a male. You know where you buy that stuff? The good old garage sale.
Oh, absolutely.
You let somebody else take the beating on it. It's like why I didn't like buying brand new cars. When you bought a car for $3,000, the minute you drove it around the block, you were out $700 on the old days. And it's got to be a ton more today that I don't know because I don't.
Oh, doubtless.
As I say, our trick was get on the freeway, and I'd have a truck with a tow bar, and my buddy would have another tow bar. And he was a body man. He could detail out a Model T Ford and make it look new, you know. And so we had this gift. We'd break out of the mountains in North Carolina at Mount Airy. And Mount Airy supposedly was this place where they filmed a lot of, you know, the show, Andy Griffith.
Yeah, well... They shot it all in Hollywood on a back lot and a soundstage, but it's conceptualized based on Mount Airy, North Carolina. That's why Mount Airy rhymes with Mayberry.
Okay.
And they've got a big festival there now, Mayberry Days and all of that. Yeah.
Well, we'd end up down in Winston-Salem where the car wholesalers were, and we'd buy them and haul them back, and we'd work on them, make sure they were running good. My buddy would detail them out, and he could pick up $1,000 a car profit. And being a hustler, you know. Because I was the kind of guy that got tired of working for other people. For instance, you worked in the garment business in Cleveland. I made sweaters, fixed the machines that made the sweaters. Patented in 1905, and they were still using them in the 60s. Profit margin, good. Anyway, or at least from the machine standpoint. We got laid off about the middle of January. You didn't go back to work until usually the first week in March. So you had 6 weeks off. And so you collect your unemployment, and I'd go wash dishes or whatever else I could do to pick up a few bucks, you know. It was the time and place. Things are so different today. That's why I feel for kids today, you go out and you go into the mud to get an education, and you still can't get a job. That's what bothers me, you know, that people are struggling to get a college degree, and what do they do with it after they're done? But I sure wish, what was the first caller's name?
Jeff.
Jeff, I agree with him in principle, and I don't know how to get the rest of the people to think along those lines. That's where I find the weakness is in the other people. And I wasn't sent here to convert people to anything, whether it's Jesus or whatever. You know, I wish I could. Because it takes a certain amount of humanity and a large amount of knowledge of the rest of the world to put those things in theory. And they say, yeah, he had me thinking the word technocracy, technocrat.
Yeah.
In other words, because their belief was that people who were skilled in the engineering of things could better run the society than politicians. Of course, nowadays, guys who worked for Barnum and Bailey and had big feet and red noses would probably run the House of Representatives better than Mr. Boehner is. I just, you know, but you know, because, Bob, I know you're not as cynical as I am, I don't think.
Oh, only on days that end in Y, Bill.
Yeah, well, you were talking about that guy at the football game. Now, what the hell are you carrying a gun to a high school football game?
Yeah, and, you know, Texas Betsy wrote last night and said, well, you know, maybe he was an off-duty cop.
Well, that could have been the only reason.
That could be true. But do I know that? No. All I know is that there was a lawful, you know, awful gun owner less than 20 feet from my family.
Well, how did you see it? Did he...
And I'm going to walk up and go, oh, by the way, sir, you with your pistol, are you an off-duty cop? Oh, that's lovely.
Did he put it on when he got out of his car? He put the rig on?
Yeah, I mean, you're not gonna go trucking around on little winding roads in West Virginia with your peacemaker hog leg strapped to the back. You're going to have it down there where you can get it at if you got to defend freedom in a hurry.
Well, I was carrying a detective special on a shoulder holster. Because,
well, this was one of those little suckers that rides on the small of your back.
With my luck, I'd get
shoot your ass off. Yes, it's okay. It's internet radio. You can say that, Bill.
I was trying to think of the name for some kind of surgical thing that I would perform on myself.
Yeah.
But not a,
yeah, you'd perform a radical tuchusectomy.
Yeah, there's a good piece of Yiddish I like. That my first wife being Jewish, I learned to speak a little. My father-in-law, he was such a funny guy. He knew I was kind of tight with the buck, and he'd always kid me. He says, "You're not Scottish, are you?" Because that was a yeah. Maybe I was.
Yeah, the old joke I heard a long time ago. The Scottish father who walks up to his son who's just sitting there wearing his glasses, his new glasses, and he says, "What?" What do you be reading? The boy says, nothing, Pa. He says, what do you be looking at through your fine new glasses? Nothing, Pa. Well, take them off. You're wasting them.
Yeah,
sorry, exactly. That's more Irish than Scots, but
yeah,
you get the idea.
It was a little... There's several things that... As I say, the situation with this... This health act is really good for people who have nothing, but it could be a lot better, and you and I know that. And
it could be universal single payer health care.
Bob, when I went to Canada so many times and would talk to people, I talked to anybody from other passengers on the bus to, because I wanted to know what they really thought of their health care system, and most of them loved it. Now, if you want to get a nose job or something, you know, something that isn't really a necessity, you may have to wait the turn for it because it's not a matter of life and death. And that's the whole problem. I mean, hell, they hauled me in October. God, what's the date today?
This would be the 22nd of October.
Well, on October the 19th of 1994. They hauled me into the hospital and they shot me with a drug called TPA, clot blaster, and blew a clot open on me.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know. But, hey, I've lived many years after. Well, the eyes have gotten me, Bob, because everything I did was tied to...
Yeah, the eyes don't have it. Sorry, that was poor humor on my part. But
that's okay. It's right up my alley. I can't tell you anything. I can't agree more. But I wish to whoever or whatever we could actually, because I think the kind of philosophy that the young man, well, young, he's, I don't know if he didn't sound that young, what he was embracing with things that, I still have friends that I argue with. They say, Bill, you're too cynical. I said, man, I wish you were right. But I don't know, there are people out there that, how the hell do you, the money and power factor motivates so many people, just they don't care what it motivates them to as long as they end up with the money and the power.
I was reading something just last night, Bill, the aim of most of the philosophies of the ancient world, whether it be Epicureanism or Stoicism or Cynicism, was to prepare one's mind to eventually have a serene death. And, of course, that was all supplanted by Christianity, which came along and said, hey, you know, it's okay if lions maul you to pieces, or if you get nailed into a T-shaped piece of lumber, or if you slaughter somebody or somebody else slaughters you. It's all okay, because, you know, you're going to have pie in the sky when you die.
Thank you, Woody.
Yeah. And you know, and I was just reflecting on what a profound difference there is between those two things.
Well, I'll leave you with a couple of things that we used to joke about when you guys probably too. the two best ways to go are to be shot by a jealous husband or be making love and have an elephant step on your back. That was the... Anyway, I'll let you go.
Well, wait, before you go, before you go. This just in from Irish Dave.
Irish Dave.
I don't have to tell you that Lindbergh knew he was over Scotland when he looked down and spotted the toilet paper hanging on the line to dry.
Good.
I knew you'd like that. Now, you know, this is all just in good fun.
No, because, the ethnic comedians in the old days before radio and television, these guys would have, the live amateur shows, and there were guys who would get up there with the accents, because they were speaking to people from their same ethnicity and the accent, and the stories they were usually telling, a lot of them were actually self-demeaning. Well, Mr. Dangerfield made a hell of a lot of money cutting himself to ribbons, and he was funnier than hell, and you know, his story is that he was a comic working the circuit, and his wife passed away. And he stopped being a comedian and raised his kids. And when they grew up, then he went back to comedy. That's why he was pretty old when he made a name for himself.
I didn't realize that. You know, Lord, the one I remember is my wife and I decided we would quit smoking, and we'd only have sex when we'd only smoke when we had sex.
Yeah.
I'm down to one cigarette every 3 months, and she's up to five packs a day.
Anyway, you take care.
You too, Bill.
Good night.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, our buddy Bill, calling from Cleveland. And just along the way, Isaac pointed out, white carpet for a white Santa beard. Isaac is a troublemaker, in case you hadn't guessed. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. If you're on hold, please stay there. I need to do a quick update on the fundraising. Thank you all very much. When Dr. John announced his challenge, our buddy Robert in Australia responded, and he said, I had completely forgotten about my 20th of the month up over, not down under, up over challenge. So he said, I'm matching Dr. John's challenge and issuing a challenge of my own. So hopefully somebody will match my $50. And then we also had a kind contribution from Luda. Thank you very much. Thank you, Luda, sincerely. Then, in anticipation of the 8th/10th anniversary of this little effort, we got a note from Mark, who said, $10 a year for 8 years. And this was after I'd made the Che Guevara remark, and he said, Viva Che! So, $10 a year. So thank you very much, Mark. And so, consequently, we are... Rick answered Robert. So, all told, we are at about $230, which gets us out of last night's hole and helps us a lot on going forward this evening. So, anybody wants to answer that last one, it is much appreciated. And, you know, it's not like it's an auction or anything, but that's how we keep all of this going. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Who have I got?
This is Todd.
Oh, hey, Todd. Welcome aboard.
Oh, well, thank you very much. First time calling here.
You'll do fine, I promise.
Oh, thank you very much. Been listening for a few months, and it's kind of ironic on right after Bill because... Kathy and I are located probably within about 30 miles of him, so we're down in Doylestown, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
And just want to say, man, you're our hero. And, you know, referencing a caller or a few calls back, you know, history shows you're right. You go back, and any time there has been any sort of overthrow or anything along those lines, the stars just seem, they need to be aligned just right, that circumstances need to be perfect for anything like that to happen. And honestly, take a look at the way society is around the world. I think it's getting close, but for some reason it's just not there. You know, the American worker has been reduced from the way that they were in the lifestyle that they've had in the 50s and the 60s to where they're working now, harder for less. It's just a matter of time before the lights go on, but it just hasn't happened yet. And sooner or later, and probably sooner, it will.
Well, I'm struggling, Todd, hoping that that lights go on moment is going to happen. Because on the one hand, I think the light is on for a lot of people. Most folks in organized labor have the lights on. People who are not members of labor organizations, you know, like me, we understand that. We understand it completely. It is obvious to us. But the fundamental problem and the essential question comes down to, and bless his heart, Bernie Sanders, rather than sitting around waiting for somebody else to do it, went out and took it on himself. Bernie Sanders took a tour through the Deep South just to ask the question, you know, what is it, you know, are you really who the for-profit media are telling us you are? That you hate the idea of organized labor, you're jealous of your neighbor if they're making a nickel more an hour. And he said it's, and I'm not at all surprised, he said that his findings are very much at odds with this blood red South idea that the for-profit media promulgate. And so the question becomes one of, you know, how do you create cohesion in that?
Well, thank goodness for Bernie, because, you know, out of anybody that occupies the halls of anywhere in Washington, man, that guy is the one guy who really deserves to be there. I think he is looking out for the people that he represents. I can't say anybody else, but the majority of them are just looking out for themselves, and that's what the polls have been showing lately. But, you know, I think the big issue is that everybody is working so hard just to put food on the table, keep themselves or their family from starving and keep them in clothes. They don't have time, like I will say, you and I, to follow what's going on.
I think there's a lot of truth in that, Todd.
Yeah, the wealthy have got the people working so hard that, you know, it takes time to follow what's going on. You've got to, you know, keep up and keep abreast on what's happening. And if you busted your butt for 8-10 hours a day or working 2 or 3 jobs, you don't have the time and or the mental capacity when you come home to sit down and be in a paper or, God forbid, try and find something on TV or listen to a program like yours or Malloy's, and really absorb what people are saying, and or if you do, the energy to do anything about it.
And do you think that's an accident, Todd?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, the Koch brothers, Adelson, you know, they know what they're doing. They've, you know, this plan has been going on since antiquity. You know, I mean, it's all you have
leisure to time. Leisure time is the devil's plaything. If the devil is to be considered as, oh, I don't know, self-determination,
right,
or self-liberation, or self-actualization, absolutely. So, if you can just take away that leisure time, or if people do have leisure time, then if you can direct it into leisure time of which you approve, then you've got it half licked. I think back to, and I don't think I've got the entirety of it pulled together, but I remember hearing an anecdote, Todd, about the rise of professional baseball. Now, I know, that may seem kind of esoteric, but and professional football for that matter. Remember, the Chicago Bears started out as the Decatur Staleys, and they were an industrial team. Many professional baseball squads wound up or got their start by being sort of clients, if you will, of major wealthy industrialists. And funneling people into the stands for baseball was a much better thing than having them sitting around wherever it was that they lived thinking about revolution. And so far better that they would beat themselves to smithereens in the streets over the Pirates versus the Reds, or the Cubs versus the Cards, or the Red Sox versus the Yankees, than to have the Red Sox fans and the Yankees fans coming together and saying, oh, wait a minute, I don't think that's our problem.
Well, wasn't it, I know it was Rome, I don't know which particular ruler, but bread and circuses.
Sure, that was a phrase that was trotted out by, I think, one of the early Christian fathers, but I may be wrong. That people were kept, people were kept compliant through bread and circuses, providing entertainment and essential food.
Right.
And that eats up whatever leisure time they have, and boom, there you go. I mean, you don't want a lot of people, you know, even sitting around composing sonnets can be dangerous. Because then the next thing you know, people are coming to listen to you read your sonnets, and they don't have control over what's in your sonnets. The power is always going to use whatever tools it has at hand to maintain a compliant workforce. Preferably a quiescent workforce, I guess.
True. Very, very true. And right now, the problem with that theory that is tilting the equation is the fact that the bread part is starting to become missing.
Well, yeah, because you've got a certain element of the authoritarian right wingers, you know, we call them teabaggers, who have decided that the bread part of bread and circuses is too expensive, and they'd rather just take their chances. Because maybe a hungry workforce of peasants, and that's the way they think of us, maybe a hungry workforce of peasants is even more compliant than a marginally well-fed workforce of peasants.
This is
an economy of desperation, isn't it?
Right. They're using fear for compliance at this point. Fear that if you've got to keep the job that you have despite the fact that it's not paying shit, and if you lose it, well, you're screwed.
And good luck with all that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you know, I don't know if you follow sport at all, but there's a story that has been sort of cataclysmically upending the sporting world lately that I couldn't help taking notice of. And of course, Dave Zirin, the great sports writer, picked up on it pretty quick. And that is this business with the players at Grambling State, Louisiana, Grambling State University in Grambling, Louisiana, who refused to play last week against their arch rival, Jackson State, from Jackson, Mississippi. Both of these, of course, are historically black colleges and universities. And when Dave Zirin published the actual complaint letter from the players, it didn't read like something from privileged athletes at institutions of higher learning. It read like a list of complaints from industrial workers of 120 years ago.
Right, I saw that story. Absolutely.
And so I read it as sort of further evidence that things are coming unstuck. Because when you compare on one hand that miserable little son of privilege, Johnny Manziel, down at Texas A&M, who managed, because his parents are rich oil people, to weasel out of a charge of having sold autographs, because he's Johnny F. and Manziel, right? and some Fox, I will never forget this, I hope, the Fox sports writer who compared him to Rosa Parks, and I still want to run screaming into the night every time I even say that. When I compare that and the, you know, gentle, not even tap, but stroking of the wrist that Johnny Manziel received, with the fact that sports fans around the country are saying, well, damned ingrate college football players are getting a free education. They're complaining about they're complaining that they have to mow the grass and the grass ain't right. And, well, why don't they get in their locker room and clean all that black mold off the walls? And I'm thinking, wow, we're way down the rabbit hole now. But it's a labor, you know, the Grambling State story, Todd, is a labor issue. This isn't a sports story. This is a labor story.
Yep.
And, you know, I got to wonder. I mean, I think, for instance, I think about Ed Schultz. Ed Schultz was a college, like, Division II quarterback or whatever. Who is covering the Grambling story outside of Dave Zirin as a labor issue as opposed to some sort of blip on the sports radar?
Exactly. I heard a little blurb of it, and that's been it. And it was a sports based story on it, and that was it. You're absolutely right.
And you know, one of the things that becomes obvious is that those players, those student athletes, which of course is a bit of a misnomer, they got pushed all the way to the breaking point, among other things, by virtue of the fact that, remember, Grambling is in Louisianistan, where Piyush Jindal's approach to everything is to either privatize it or kill it. Mm-hmm. And so funding has been steadily cut and cut and cut and cut at Grambling State until you've got nobody there to cut the grass on the practice field. And these guys were talking about... You know, football is not something that can... They're playing in literally playing in knee-high grass. Or practicing in knee-high grass.
Well,
because the money for the budget for the maintenance crew got axed.
Well, that's just the price you pay for a free education.
Well, and freedom, right? I mean, free... Yeah.
Wolverines!
Yeah,
sorry.
Right, see? It all makes so much sense.
Uh-huh. And, you know, to change directions here a little bit, you know, you go back to the story about being with the life expectancy of people. And, you know, it carries on from that. I can, you know, tie it in with the college. I was working as a television photographer and had a problem with my back. They told me I wasn't going to go back to do that. So I went back and did the proper thing and got a new education and racked up the debt that involved and was done, was computer based. And 4 months before I got out, Silicon Valley went to hell. So I tried to find a job here because the bottom fell out here when it fell out down there. Couldn't find it. They couldn't find a job. And so student loans were coming due. The only thing I could think about doing was going back for additional education. So I went back for an advanced degree, racked up more debt, and lo and behold, the old injury from my neck, made me out permanently disabled. Now I'm stuck in the system with that, with people calling up, knocking at the door, wanting money for student loans that we've got zero money coming in. Sorry, it's not there. What do you do? You play within the system and you end up, you know, getting raked over the coals. What the hell do you do?
And I don't know the answer to that, but it's a horrible thing when you become afraid of your own telephone.
Yeah, right. That's what it is. And
when you know whatever walk you make to the mailbox becomes like a walk across the Bridge of Sighs in Renaissance Venice.
Yes, yes.
And it becomes paralyzing.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the first shows that Kathy and I tuned into, Kathy and I are married, share the house, we just have different computers, but one of the first shows we tuned into, and you know, my dear wife is disabled also. She has psoriatic arthritis that kept getting worse and worse. And she came out to be disabled, or turned out to be disabled also. Fortunately, she got spit out the other end of the system with a thumbs up, so at least that's a little light at the end of the tunnel. But you mentioned something about people's attitudes when you have chronic pain, but people don't see you as being disabled because you're not walking around in a cast or have some sort of visible...
Right, no iron lung, no disability.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, that was enough to pique our curiosity and tune in again. And since then, we've been waving the flag of Bob Kincaid, and you've been our hero. And I just got to say, thank you very much. You've got loyal fans here. And, you know, it's just been fantastic.
Well, you're not fans, you're family. Okay? I mean, this is...
Well...
I mean, we're not joking when we say the Horn Family Commune. So, you know...
Well, we...
Stick around.
Oh, absolutely. There's no worries there. But and the more we listen, the more we sit there and kind of look at each other and go, "My God, there's other people out there like us. There's more of us. Wow, this is good." Because you know, Ohio, it's got its little blue areas and surrounded by red.
Yeah, bobbing along in a sea of blood red. I know. And that's, but that's the way a lot of the country is. If you're close to something like a metropolitan center, you're more likely to be bluish. But if you go out into the hinterlands where the silos are and the grain elevators, they're standing, you know, the next thing you know, you're at the doctor's office and your intake nurse is telling you that Barack Obama is a Muslim. I'm sorry, I'm not climbing up on the cross because I know we all need the wood and everything, but that moment in time just sticks with me, Todd. Of all the things I could have expected to hear when I'm going in and going over, I went in to go over my blood work.
Uh-huh.
And somewhere in the middle of talking about my bun and my creatinine, I don't know. I don't know if I had Obama Muslim blood cells in there or something. Yeah, okay, bun's good, creatinine's good, blood glucose is good. Damn, your triglycerides suck. Obama's a Muslim. Are they Muslim triglycerides? You know, for F's sakes.
Well, we had the same thing. We live close to the center of town. We got a doctor's office. Two, maybe three in this thriving megalopolis that we're in. And diagonal across the street, you walk into the doctor's office, and the first thing I hear is a complaint about, oh, this damn Obamacare stuff, it's going to drive us out of business. This stuff absolutely...
Oh, I got that too, yeah. Obamacare's already taken away all their hard copy files and making them use the evil... satanic Muslim computer boxes.
Right, yep, and they're going to turn out to be going to turn us into a communist society before, you know, we even have a chance to blink again.
Right, because God forbid that anybody besides them should know, for instance, that I have a malrotated bowel. I guess I've got to get it tattooed on my belly, and I'm a real pain sissy. I don't want tattoos, but. You know, they've made us go to computer records, and God forbid that, you know, maybe I'm in D.C. or something, Todd, and I got to go get some sort of medical treatment, and they, you know, we don't want them looking at a computer database and going, well, look at that, how about that, Bob's got a malrotated bowel, son of a gun. No, Obama's a Muslim, so that can only be on a written paper file in a little clinic in rural West Virginia that is guarded closely by somebody who thinks Obama is a Muslim.
Yeah, right. Nobody else needs to know about that. Absolutely. And anytime you need to go make a trip to the doctor or have an emergency or anything else, you go to that one spot where they have your records, and That's it.
Right, you know, because you're somewhere else and they have to do some surgery on your innards and they cut you open. Well, wait a minute, where's his gizzard? his gizzard ain't in the right place. Oh.
Yeah.
I remember an old buddy of mine a long time ago would end every phone call saying, "It's madness, Bob, it's madness." And it is. It's madness, Todd.
Yep, yep. Just like putting down white carpet with cats, or doing hair. Cassie has a propensity, or I can't say did. I think I broke her of it, of wicker furniture, and we've got three cats.
Well, so it's the wicker furniture is kind of fuzzy now from the clawing.
Yeah, right. It just turns into a big scratching post.
And it's got to feel so good if you're a cat. I mean,
oh, yeah, right, yeah, because every night you could hear them scratching, pulling. Yeah, right.
Well, at least, you know, at least it's not a 400-year-old Chippendale or something, because, well, you might get a little short over that, Todd.
Well, yeah, you got a point there. Fortunately, it's...
And steel patio furniture just doesn't look good in the living room. Maybe I'm old-fashioned.
Hey, now wait a minute. Do you got some way of spying on us and checking out our... Just because the neighbor threw it away and we scratched it out, that doesn't mean anything.
Here, scratch this, kitty.
That's right.
Knock yourself out.
Right. I'm going to get up the line here and let somebody else have their turn. It was great chatting with you, and you got a couple of new family members.
Wonderful.
And we're with you, man. Absolutely.
All right. Take care, Todd, and say hi to Kathy for us.
Will do. You take care, buddy.
All right. Bye now. Love getting that first-time call and letting folks see that they got through it just fine. Thanks, Todd. Thanks so much for the call. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How are you?
Hey, John.
Doing good to hear from you, and awesome to hear a first caller. So, hey, Todd, how's it going? And good best to you and your family there.
Awesome. It's just nice to see the family expand.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I wanted to see. I know we're running short, but I wanted to see how the challenge is going. I had to drop out for a second.
It went surprisingly well. Our buddy Ed jumped in before I was even got a chance to announce your challenge. Ed jumped in, and then Robert in Australia jumped in and matched your challenge and called for somebody to match his. Then Luda jumped in and helped, and then Mark jumped in and with a contribution of $10 for every year of the 8 years we've been on the air. So it's been a really good night, and we're out of last night's hole in a big way, and now we're just digging out of tonight.
All right, that's awesome. It's so nice to see folks all coming together over something that we believe in. That's really, really encouraging.
It is. Believe you me, it is, because I've had more scares over the continued existence of this little enterprise, please. In the last month than in the last 8 years, and this is just, yeah. You know, well, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I've been around for a big chunk of that. Listen, I know we're running short, but I wanted to say, just talk real briefly about something that touches on a lot of stuff tonight. And that's debt.
Okay.
And we're all familiar with it. But the thing about debt is when you look at it in a long perspective, debt is something that's really good, and it's something that, in its own way, is actually kind of beautiful. And I'm talking long-term, long scale, like human history scale, okay?
Okay.
So, roll with me on this.
Oh, I'm right here. I think I know where you're going, but I'm not going to jump out there yet.
Okay, cool. So, imagine it's a non-Western part of the world now, non-money economy, or even, you know, go a little farther back in history. It's 5,000 years ago, and you and your folks are cattle herders, you know, and so you're running around Northern Europe and everything's dandy and you're herding your cows and you're living with your family group and there's about 50 people in your little community and you guys go about your business and you're herding your cows and eating the cheese and the yogurt and the milk, and every now and then you guys start to think, you know what would go really great with this milk and this yogurt is some grain. And those guys next to us down the street, down the valley, they grow lots of grain, but they don't have any cows. So maybe what would be really cool is if we could offer them some of our cows and some of our cheese and some of our milk, and maybe they'd give us some grain. And so to kick this all off, you and your people get together and you get a whole bunch of milk and cheese and yogurt together and maybe a cow or two, and you drive down to a clearing down the valley and you leave the stuff there. And you let the farmers know that there's some stuff there for them. And they come up the valley to the clearing and they drop off some grain there. And they drop off a little bit more than you guys left. And so you aren't there now, or I guess you are now, in their debt. You have an obligation there. So the next time you get to wanting some grain, you offer them a little bit more cows and milk and cheese, and they give you a little less grain, and then they're in your debt. So that creates this obligation that now you got to trade some more with them, and then next time they got to trade a little bit more with you. And this goes on and on and on, and your two little groups are perpetually in or out of debt with the other one. And that obligation is never really settled. It's never really paid off. But what it does is it compels you to keep trading with each other and to get a better relationship. Sometimes maybe you send off some of your sons or daughters to marry into the group, and they send some to yours. And maybe when those jerks up in the hills come down and try to raid your cows or your grain, you go and you help out each other. And you basically build an alliance over exchange.
Yeah, those jerks up in the hills, probably my ancestors, John.
Your folks, exactly. And so the thing is, we have this image of non-Western, you know, quote-unquote primitive people or people, you know, humans in the past, as being really simple and living kind of unencumbered lives and kind of going about their own business, doing their own thing, not having obligations and debts in exchange. And it's nonsense. We always trade. And what we see in small-scale societies today is that everybody's kind of perpetually in debt to everybody else. And it's really complex, but the thing about giving and taking in exchange is that it's not about profit. It's not about a zero-sum game. It's about building relationships and alliances with other people.
Right, because you don't because when you go down the hill with your cheese and your yogurt and your cattle and your milk, you're not taking them the milk that's about to spoil or the cheese that didn't quite come out right or the yogurt that's kind of skanky or the cow with a rib showing to get one over on the other side, which is kind of the capitalist model, isn't it, John? There is an inherent act of goodwill there, isn't there?
Well, it's kind of goodwill, but it's also just really good sense. Because, I mean, if you give them the crappy yogurt, they're going to give you the moldy grain. And nobody wants moldy grain. You know, you can't make beer out of it. Come on, right?
Right.
So there's a sense of goodwill, but more importantly, there's a sense of self-preservation. Because, you know, if you give a little bit more, then they're obligated to help you. So maybe a plague hits your cows, and all of a sudden you're looking at starvation. You can go down the hill and say, hey, guys, you know, we've always given you a little bit more. We're having a hard time. Maybe you can help us out because we've established by our relationship here that we're good trading partners. You know, we're good folks. We're going to give you stuff when you need it. So it's actually very rational. And the whole point is you never want debt to go away. You want it to be there because it creates social tie.
And yet here, does that equate, does that translate, John, into the question of the right wing who constantly screams about how we're drowning in debt and we're going to turn into Greece?
Right. Well, see, that's the problem, is that when we start to make money from money churning around and people stand to profit from it, then we get this idea that debt should be settled, that debt should go away, because we don't any longer give and take in exchange to build social ties. We give and take in exchange to try to come out on top. And the people who are giving us the money to do that also want to come out on top. So the point is, the way we think about debt, about money, about winners and losers in trading is really, really, really artificial. it's something that
inorganic,
like anybody. Yeah, it's inorganic because right, we don't see ourselves as part of a system. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly. and that little micro situation of, you know, one clan group next to another clan group, or down the hill from, or up the hill from, expands fairly rapidly. And I get, you know, I get all misty-eyed and wonder-filled when I think about the way this stuff develops. You know, my experience is largely New World stuff, although I'm completely fascinated with the old. But I will never forget, and it's the only time I got to do it, you know, little 20-year-old Bob out there with his Marshalltown down in the sterile pit that he hadn't been told was sterile. You know, they just put me somewhere I couldn't screw anything up, or, you know, for 4 weeks, and then they let me come up to the grown-up dig, and seeing something like a mica disc mirror.
Yeah.
And knowing that the nearest place that a mica disc mirror could have reached southwest Tennessee from was Michigan. And then think about a culture that has no draft animals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not somebody coming from Michigan to southwest Tennessee. That mica disc mirror made a trip little by little by little, community to community to community, until it wound up in southwest Tennessee in a mound.
And at every point, it tied different groups of people together. And it was a tiny little medium of saying, hey, we're friends, we're going to help each other out, we're going to trade. Doesn't really matter if it doesn't balance, because I know you got my back later on. Exactly. That's how we've always worked. So this whole system we've got is really, really, really new. It's artificial. We're not adapted to it. And it's predatory. Whereas in the past, you know, humans have always exchanged for more or less good reasons.
And mutual benefit.
And mutual benefit, even if it's not immediate.
And there's no mutual benefit to be found in a predatory system, is there, John?
Not at all. And to participate in that, we have to be convinced over and over again through all kinds of different ways that we are not actually tied to other folks. You know, this is that whole individual cult that we have.
Oh, with the bootstraps.
Yeah, with the bootstraps. Yeah, exactly. And so that's where you get these screams, oh, we got to pay our obligations, we got to settle everything, we got to run the government like we run a household budget. Like, first of all, you know, no, we don't. I mean, the fact is that we do, because there are intermediaries there. There are people who try to skim a cutoff. But if you're talking about sort of how to, you know, devalue circulation of money and start to value more like making things and consuming things, that's one way to go. You know, it's not that we can't change the system through laws. Of course we can. We can outlaw things like, you know, interest in lending and usury. And it's funny that the Muslims do that.
Or we could we could do something that the Christians profess to favor. We could declare Jubilee and the cancellation of debt.
Yeah, exactly. And it would benefit everybody, and it'd be a great little step to sort of saying, hey, everything's clean, you know, maybe we can start over and try to buy and sell and make stuff with the idea that this benefits everybody.
Yeah, to go back to Todd's call, John, and there's been some talk of it, it's usually couched in terms of relief, which I think is sort of a non-starter and immediately poisons the process, because it turns it into, it reconceptualizes it as welfare, which we know is fraught with baggage for people who aren't us. You know, what about a student? You know, what would happen in this economy if we had a student debt jubilee? I mean, I can imagine that I'm probably talking to someone to whom that would mean a great deal.
Well, it would mean a lot, but it would even mean more than just having a lot more free money for people who are, or free income for people who are just starting out. It would do things like freeing up people to go to college without having to go directly into a part of the predatory workforce. It would free up law students to go into things like social justice law and environmental law, things that don't pay really well, but is locked out of a lot of people are locked out of it because they have to pay the debt, so they have to go work on Wall Street.
Exactly. So and I saw that, you know, I saw that happen time and time again, coming out of law school. You know, you've got it, because it almost goes without fail in state university law schools where people are incurring debt to go to school, that the guy, the girl, the woman or man who is you know, law review editor, moot court board, you know, order of the coif, all of that stuff, who comes out with the with the perfect grade point average. Well, you know, you'll find out in May that they're going to start in May of, you know, before graduation. Well, it turns out that they're going to get a job making $80,000 a year. I mean, those were the good old days. For some silk stocking defense firm whose entire being is predicated on a pyramid scheme that is that spends all its time and effort in making sure that massive predatory corporations are never held accountable.
Yeah.
And so that brilliant mind that has been trained for 3 years can't go out and do good for people. Instead, that brilliant mind goes out and does evil for corporations. And I know I'm speaking rather starkly, but that's the essence of it, isn't it?
Yeah, out of necessity. So the point of Jubilee, I mean, student loan relief, I mean, you know, I would love it, but it would have much more than an obvious immediate benefit. It would free up people to, you know, go into humanities, social science, you know, things like that that are good and important, but don't.
And that goes back to the other end of the spectrum. You know, my notion that Social Security ought to be paid out at the age of 55 so that people can go and do the things that they dreamed of doing. For instance, you know, I think of my father. He wanted to be a college football coach. That was his dream. But instead, he wound up on a furnace floor because there was a family to feed, and I understand that. But for instance, if you consider, John, and we're running out of time, I'm sorry, but if you consider people being able down the road end of the spectrum, being able to go out and make their communities better instead of slaving away till the end of their days. One of the things that I didn't mention that I took out of that alternate story about mortality is the realization, and it was, you know, it was heartbreaking. It damn near brought tears to my eyes when I thought about it. The average lifespan in McDowell County, West Virginia, is 63. That means the average male in McDowell County never receives a penny, John, of Social Security.
Yep.
And I say there's something wrong with that system.
Absolutely.
John, thank you so much for the thought-provoking conversation. And thanks for getting the ball rolling this evening, too. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great program. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye now. And so we close out with some food for thought from Dr. John. Thanks, everybody, for helping get us out of last night's hole and throwing in a few shovelfuls of dirt on tonight's hole. We'll be back tomorrow night, prayer meeting Wednesday, and I've been saving stories already, and I think it's going to be a humdinger. Thanks to everybody who makes this whole effort go, you with your kind contributions. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to Ben Birch. Thank you to John Fox. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And here comes Rick Smith on the horn.